Morning, everybody. I'd like to go ahead and call Senate Finance Committee to order. Time is 3 minutes after 9 a.m., February 13th, 2012. With me today is Co-Chair Senator Hoffman, Senator Ellis, Senator Olson, Senator Thomas, Senator Egan. We have a joint meeting this morning. We've invited the Senate Resources Committee. We have the co-chairs here, Senator Pascavan, Senator Wagner. We also have room for other members of the Resources Committee. Excuse me. Today we'll hear the first of four-part presentation by Pedro Van Meers. We will adjourn at 10:30 today because we have a conflicting meeting scheduled to get ready for the floor. We will reconvene at 1 o'clock this afternoon on the same subject matter, and then tomorrow we'll continue both morning and afternoon with the presentation, so we have it broken down into four segments. So with us today is Pedro Van Meers, and I'd like him to go ahead and introduce himself for the committee, give us a little bit of his background, working relations, not only professional background, but working relationship with the state over time. Even though a lot of us are familiar with him, there'll be folks at home that aren't, and then people that don't watch the oil and gas discussion as much as others may not be familiar with him and his past relationship. And we've been joined here with the Senator French from the Resources Committee also, and Senator Stevens from the Resources Committee. Mr. Van Meers.
It is a very great pleasure to be again in Juneau, and I'm kind of you to allow me to present myself. Of course, I have been, I graduated in the Netherlands in economic geology with a PhD. Then I immigrated to Canada and worked in the Canadian oil industry as a consultant for many years. I have been since 1974 my own consultant, and my main line of work is advising governments around the world about petroleum taxation and fiscal terms. I have done so. I have advised more than 80 governments around the world, worked in more than 80 countries in every continent doing this kind of work. In 1997, I had the honor to work with Governor Knowles at the time, because at that time there was the possibility for LNG exports to Asia, and we worked on the so-called Alaska Stranded Gas Act. Then from 2003 onwards, I had the honor to work with Governor Murkowski on two topics: one, the famous gas line, and two, the PPT, as it was called at that time, the new tax that was introduced to assure better revenues for the state from the petroleum resources. I was very kindly invited by Representative Hawker in December to give a seminar for legislators with background on the current conditions in the oil industry. And so I have been in and out of Alaska many times. I think I have a good understanding of the issues in the state. It is a great pleasure to give this presentation.
And if we could just, for the folks watching at home, Representative Hawker is the chairman of the Joint Committee, Legislative Budget and Audit, that handles our consultants as a joint working relationship with both bodies. And Mr. Van Meers did a two-day seminar in Anchorage that the entire legislature was invited to, some of which will be repeated over the next 2 days here.
So what I hope to do this morning is have the first session on a series of four that deals with policy options for Alaska oil and gas. The objective of Governor Purnell is to achieve a throughput of 1 million barrels per day through TAPS. I personally believe that goal is achievable. entirely from the state of Alaska resources, and it is achievable, say, in the next 10 or 15 years or so. Of course, it is also my view that House Bill 110 does not even come close to taking a major step towards that goal, and consequently, I think a far more elaborate legislation would be required if Alaska indeed wants to see significant increases in production. What I hope to do in the four sessions is that it will be clear that major policy changes are required, as well as major fiscal changes that I hope to discuss during the seminar. If you want to reach a million barrels a day, you have to encourage very significant higher levels of investment. In order to reach that, in addition to whatever the companies are investing today, you would need to invest at least $7.5 billion a year to reach that goal, so that gives you an idea. Today, companies approximately reinvesting $10 to $15 a day per barrel. You would need to reinvest about $50 per barrel if you want to reach this goal. So a major shift would be required in investment patterns if you want to increase production in Alaska. Yes,
Senator Stevens?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I don't know if you're coming back to the main barrels. Will you be discussing that later, or is this the only moment you will be mentioning that goal of a million barrels a day?
No, Senator Stevens, what I hope to do through the entire seminar is illustrate step by step how you can reach that goal.
And Mr. Chairman, I guess my question to you is, it your belief that this is a good goal to try to achieve? Is a million barrels a day a good thing for Alaska?
No, of course, what is good for Alaska is for Alaskans to decide. If when I was, say, at the seminar and in other seminars in Alaska, it is my impression that young Alaskan entrepreneurs and young Alaskans look for the future in the state, look for new opportunities, look for new business opportunities, new employment, and obviously with a declining oil production as it is, that may not materialize unless you bring new resources on stream. So if you believe that it is good to create employment and new business opportunities for Alaskans, then I think it would be a good goal.
Senator Wagner.
Morning, Pedro. You said it takes $7.5 billion a year over the current levels to reach that goal. What would it take to reach the goal if we had, some of us had a goal of, say, 600,000 barrels constant in production?
Now, in order to produce heavy oil, say, and other resources that you need to produce, more expensive resources than today, you need about $30 a barrel investment. So consequently, if you want to achieve for every $100,000 per day that you want for one day, you need to invest $3 million. So it is an enormous amount of investment required to reach even an extra 100,000, because don't forget the ongoing production will still be declining. So if you want to stabilize at 600, say in 20 years or 15 years, you would have to produce an additional 200,000 barrels a day.
Okay, follow up again. Could you please, it's going to be kind of awkward with the way the recording system, but we need to speak into the microphones so the recorders pick them up.
Just a follow-up. Pedro, we've been told by both major producers on the North Slope that are currently operating the field that they're not demanding or even requesting anything to do with heavy oil or viscous oil until 8 to 10 years from now. They're not ready. Their fields, they feel, are much different than the fields that they're using in situ in Alberta, for instance, because of the permafrost and other things they're dealing with up there. So I don't see how we can figure into this anything doing with viscous and heavy oil right now.
No, I do not. Of course, they may not be ready because, I mean, for the current fiscal terms, indeed, I would not be ready either. I don't see any special insurmountable conditions in the heavy oil in the North Slope that with the right fiscal package would not be reasonable encouragement to invest. Under the current conditions, yes, I agree, there is no incentive to invest in heavy oil. I don't think there is any logic to setting a timeline as when these heavy oil resources would be ready. It is ready when you have the technology. It is relatively simple heavy oil. It is not 10 degree API, it is 20 degree or 18 degree API. I don't see any obstacles why it couldn't be produced with the right fiscal terms. So I do believe that companies are, as I will explain later, are in the process of drawing cash out of Alaska. That is their goal. So I can understand that they may not be that interested right now in reinvesting in heavy oil.
Okay. Go ahead and continue, Mr. Vanier.
Of course, if there are major policy changes, then we will also see significant possibilities for LNG exports. In the seminar, I'm suggesting to have four sessions. One, the new policy framework required. Two, this afternoon, I hope to address the international competitive environment. Tomorrow, I hope to provide a detailed proposal as to how I believe fiscal terms can be structured to bring all resources on stream. And in the afternoon, I hope to extend that proposal to also include heavy oil, shale oil, and natural gas. So first, the new framework required. The new framework is based on a study that was also purchased by the legislature, and it is called World Rating of Oil and Gas Terms. So much of the material to be presented will be from that study. The study is available in the legislature if you want to do some further reading, and you can also find it on the website petrocash.com. Of the study, four volumes are ready. I'm about to put the shallow water study on the website, and then only two studies are left, which hopefully will come in the next few months.
Hold it for a second. Can we back up a slide, please? Back up to seven. Could you give us a little more background on this world rating system? Because it's been in the press a lot around the state the last for the last 9 months, as the volumes became public, and I think there were some delays in publication, maybe some extra data requests or publication challenges. Could you give us a little bit more of a rundown on this, what this thing is, and
yes,
why we should pay attention to it?
Oh, sorry. Yeah, what my firm occasionally does, the last time I did it was in 1997, is make a complete overview of the world, of all of the fiscal systems of the world, and see from an investor perspective how attractive they are, how they rate in attractiveness, so that governments as well as investors can see where the most attractive opportunities are from a fiscal point of view. It doesn't necessarily mean that it is attractive from a geological or other points of view, but this is a fiscal rating. In this study, I will be rating 140 countries in this world, so essentially all the countries that have fiscal systems or have oil and gas production or in which exploration is taking place. So it is a very elaborate study. I do the study per logistical environment, so to speak, so you cannot really compare the economics of, say, a well in Alberta to a deep water oil field in Angola. You have to compare apples with apples. So what I do is I have one study on North American wells, on the continental North American wells, one study on deep water, one study on Arctic conditions, and those three studies have been already released to the legislature. Shallow water is about to come, and then I will turn my attention to the onshore, and then I will make a final overview of that study. So the purpose of the study is to provide governments and investors with an idea as to how attractive the particular fiscal systems are to investors based on a whole series of profitability and risk criteria. That is basically the idea of the study.
Okay, thank you.
During the seminar, I will give some proposals on Alaska terms. These are not very detailed proposals. The proposals are made to just give the order of magnitude, to give the style of fiscal system that I think is necessary, and the order of magnitude of the amounts that need to be adopted. Of course, you can fine-tune these matters if the legislator or the Senate would be interested in a part of it or any of it. You would have to fine-tune it more to optimize the various numbers. But I think it is important to first give the order of magnitude and the style of the system before you go in further details. During the presentation, I will use quite extensively the concept of government take, and sometimes there is a little bit of a misunderstanding on that concept. So I have in this slide here a very simple calculation of how you determine the government take. For instance, if the gross revenues are $100 per barrel and the costs are $20 per barrel, then what you call the divisible income or the pre-tax profit would be $80 a barrel. Suppose you had a 10% royalty, 10% of the 100, that is, that means $10 a barrel, what would be the government take? Now, the way you set the government take is you take the payments to government and divide it by the pre-tax profit. So that is how you determine it. So it is not a percentage of gross, it is a percentage of net. That is very important to realize. For the economist, I do this on an undiscounted real basis, and I'm using 2% inflation and escalation. So that is how the government take numbers are determined, say, that are presented in this presentation. As I mentioned, I do not believe that House Bill 110 would lead to increases in oil production. The light oil production is declining. If better terms would be offered for new petroleum, I think there would be some investment in new light oil. I cannot see that changing the major trend of declining oil production. If you want to start increasing oil production, then you have to start tapping the other resources in this state. The state has huge heavy oils, recoverable probably 5 billion barrels, so the heavy oils alone are sufficient to reach the a million barrel a day mark for at least 20 or 25 years. Potentially, that is not yet certain. I will discuss this in more detail. There might be shale oil. If there is shale oil, that could also be very large volumes. Who knows? You can even produce some liquids by converting gas into GTL. Now, all of this will not be produced unless the fiscal terms are different from what they are today, and unless you even define fiscal terms. Today, there are no fiscal terms. The policy change that is required, as I will explain later, as I mentioned, I did a large study in 1997. I'm doing another large study today of the competitive environment of the world. Probably the most important thing for Alaska is that the competitors of Alaska have changed dramatically. And I will explain that later. But because the competitors of Alaska have changed rather dramatically, the style of doing business has to change also in order to compete with these new competitors. And that means that Alaska has to do two things. One, they have to define what the fiscal terms are so investors know what the terms are. And two, for large projects, they have to offer fiscal stability on these terms. And this is, of course, a major departure of where the state is today. What is probably one of the most amazing things about Alaska? Alaska is the only jurisdiction in this world that doesn't have defined terms. As I just mentioned, I'm doing currently the shallow water study. The shallow water study will cover 125 countries. For all these countries, nations have defined what the fiscal system for gas is. Alaska is the only country or jurisdiction that has not defined at least viable terms for gas. And this is an interesting example. Also, of course, although there are terms for light oil, there are no terms for heavy oil, and there are no terms for shale oil. If you go to any of the competing jurisdictions of Alaska, there are terms today for these resources. So consequently, that is currently a major obstacle for investment. If you don't know what the terms are, how are you going to invest? And that is, I think, a major obstacle to attract new investment. So consequently, I do believe that if Alaska wants to achieve 1 million barrels a day, if Alaska wants to achieve a much higher level of investment, the first step is you have to say what the terms are. Otherwise, investors in Dubai, in Singapore, in London, anywhere in the world cannot judge whether it is interesting to come to Alaska or not. So this is a major deficiency of the current political structure in my mind. And consequently,
Mr. Andrews, if we can back up to that slide, what I'm going to do is just have you go through each individual slide, and then if questions come up from the senators, we'll have the questions on that slide. That way, you can do your presentation, you know, without interruption on that slide itself. Senator French.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Now, this may just be a question of semantics, but when you say we don't have terms, I just wonder how that squares with the fact that we have a fairly comprehensive oil tax system on the books that will, you know, take into account the different prices and the different expenses, for example, between producing light oil and producing heavy oil. I can understand what you're saying. I guess I understand what you mean when you say they're not designed for heavy oil, but we thought a lot about that when we passed ACES. We put into place a system that says, you know, if you have high costs, you get to deduct them all. If you have low costs, you deduct them. And those high costs, of course, keep you from having to pay tax until you've produced a profit. So maybe we can do better for heavy oil and shale oil, and we're looking forward to your presentation. But I guess I'd bristle a little bit when you say we have no terms whatsoever. It seems like an overstatement to me.
Could you? Yes. I think you have no viable terms for gas. I mean, the BOE concept really is not a viable concept. The terms of the current ACES terms are clearly oriented towards light oil. They are designed in the light oil environment, and they were not, in fact, we had very lengthy discussions about heavy oil when the first PPT was designed, and we never designed special rates or special provisions for heavy oil. So I don't necessarily say that there are no terms for heavy oil. There are no terms that are specifically designed for heavy oil like you would have in Alberta, like you would have in North Dakota, like you would have, say, in Colombia or any other nation that has similar resources. So I don't want to sound extreme here. There are no terms that are actually designed for that logistical environment.
When we did PPT, the first go-around, as I recall, we had quite a bit of discussion on the 20% capital credit targeting the heavy cost of heavy oil, mm-hmm. because it's Senator French had mentioned, it's a net system and should be somewhat flexible when your costs increase.
Absolutely correct. The PTT, when it was designed at the time, there were considerable discussions on the possibility of stimulating heavy oil. At the time, the whole reason, as you say, for switching from the ELF system, which was based on the gross revenues, to a profit-based system, was to create a system that in principle could be easily adjusted to heavy oil, because since it is cost sensitive, it is easy to adjust it to higher cost. When actually the rates were set and reset, the rates were set and reset on the basis of light oil economics, not on the basis of heavy oil economics. And consequently, say the current ACES, for sure, the rates are entirely based on the economics of, say, Prudhoe Bay and other large fields on the North Slope. They're not based on, say, Uknu or Polaris or other fields in that area.
Okay. Have any other questions on the slide? Okay. Go ahead and continue, please.
It will be somewhat difficult to introduce those new terms, and I'd like to explain later why, because, interestingly, Alaska has some structural kind of problems in how you develop policy. The first thing is, interestingly, if I work in what you call small jurisdictions around the world, like Alaska, not in size, but in population, that is, small jurisdictions around the world, like Alaska, like Trinidad and Tobago, like Bahrain, like countries of that nature, policy is developed kind of differently than in large nations. And so small, and I will explain that a little bit later. Also, there is a somewhat unfavorable dependency relationship in Alaska, where people feel they depend on big oil, so to speak, and that sometimes results in resentment. So there is a structural environment in Alaska that is not particularly favorable for the introduction of the policy measures that I'm proposing. As I mentioned, there is quite a significant different way of doing business in small communities, in small populations, say less than 2 million people per jurisdiction, and large populations. If you get to a small island like Trinidad and Tobago, investors can meet directly with the Prime Minister in Alaska, with the governor. There is a very desire on the community to be involved anytime there is a fiscal decision made. So many people in the communities are affected if a new project is designed. So there is a tendency in small communities to develop kind of project by project and kind of discuss each project in the community and then set terms for that particular project. And that is a process that over time leads to rather big complications, because the terms are going to be different for the different projects, and each terms has so their own bells and whistles. And consequently, it also often involves lengthy negotiations to set the terms, and consequently that is the way kind of small communities like to work. Sometimes that can be a major advantage. Take Qatar, for instance. Qatar, population of only 1.7 million, has worked project by project and is now the largest gas exporter in the world and has the highest GDP per capita exporting gas. So you can see that small communities, because they sometimes can take decisions faster, sometimes have an advantage over the bigger communities. Of course, large populations, you can see it here yourself in the outer continental shelf. If you go to the outer continental shelf of the United States, in principle, terms are the same everywhere. And that is, there is one kind of broad system. Royalties may be somewhat different bidding round by bidding round, and that's it. And the same in Norway, the same in Alberta. If you want to build an oil sand plant, that's it. These are your terms. So large nations often, interestingly, have simpler terms, and consequently, they're often easier to understand. And large nations don't deal project by project. Like if Shell, for instance, wants to develop or explore the Burger, field. They don't walk to the White House and say, hey, what can you do for us on this field? That's not the way you can do business, say, with the federal government. So it is a different style of doing business. Now, unfortunately, the environment in Alaska has changed. The international competitive environment has changed very dramatically over the last 15 years. 15 years ago, what was the economic environment? 15 years ago, of course, oil prices were low. European and Asian gas prices were low. LNG trade was very limited. The focus was still entirely on conventional oil and gas. And in fact, the conventional oil and gas production of the United States was declining. That was the world of 1997. So where did oil companies go to find opportunities for other conventional oil resources? Now they went to Latin American countries, African countries, Asian countries. In these countries, you often have to negotiate your way through. You often have to sign production sharing contracts. It may take 2 or 3 years or a year or whatever to sign up a contract. So, you know, negotiating deal by deal in 1997 was actually the way of doing business. That's so Alaska was not very different from the rest of the world at that time. There was only really one large competitor for LNG with Alaska for the Pacific market at the time, and that was Qatar. Now that world has changed dramatically.
If we could back up
yes, please.
To 16. And could you elaborate a little bit more on your center slide where it says competitors of Alaska?
Sorry, the what?
The middle of your slide 16.
15?
16.
16.
The middle of your slide.
Oh, the competitors of Alaska. Sorry, yeah.
Yes. If you could elaborate on that list and why Latin America, Africa, and Asian developing countries are on there relative to Alaska?
The reason was that in those days, as you well know, oil production in the U.S. was declining. There was not really very large investment opportunities left in the United States in conventional oil under $20 or $15 a barrel. So there were not very much opportunities left even in Britain in the North Sea, in Norway, maybe still some. But investors, in order to find low-cost conventional oil, they had to go to new areas. They had to go to new countries, to new areas that were open for exploration to find that oil and gas. And consequently, the tendency was to go to Congo Brazzaville, to go to Chad, to go to, say, Bolivia, new countries that opened up to see whether you could find this relatively low-cost oil and gas. And so Alaska was actually competing with other nations that had investment opportunities and that were typically relatively low-cost, had relatively low-cost oil resources. But in all of those nations, like India, like Indonesia, you had to negotiate your way through to get so-called production sharing contracts for the development of the oil. So that were, you know, if I talk about competitors of Alaska, I mean alternative countries where investors would like to invest in. And consequently, that were at the time the competitors of Alaska. So consequently, the opportunities were in new countries in Latin America, Africa, and the Asia. Russia was still largely closed at that time. It was officially open, but it didn't really have a viable legal system to work in. So that was the environment, say, in 1997. Is that?
Thank you.
Now, this world has changed dramatically. Of course, now we have high oil prices. Europe and Asia have largely linked their gas prices to oil, and consequently, gas prices in Japan are now the highest in the world. It is in the order of $14 per million BTU compared to the $2.50 in Henry Hub. Europe has very high gas prices now, around $11 per million BTU in Germany. So here you see there are now very high gas prices in Europe and Asia. As a result of those high gas prices, LNG trade is now booming. Anybody is trying to supply Asia with LNG, and consequently this has now become a booming market. However, what is probably also very important for Alaska is that we are actually no longer living in the age of conventional oil anymore. We are now living in the age of unconventional oil. Most of the investments in North America are going into unconventional resources, not in conventional resources any longer. So that is the new area of investment. And the most interesting thing today is actually oil production in the US and Canada is now increasing because of the circumstances. So we have an entirely new world. And the problem is Alaska has stayed a little bit behind in adjusting to this new world. It is fantastic that the three majors have now announced that they're going to look at LNG sales to the East Asian market, but the East Asian market has been at high prices for the last 5 years, so that is not what you call aggressive resource development. So consequently, here you see Alaska is kind of a little bit behind now in this overall new environment. The consequence of this new environment is that Alaska is now competing with other states in the United States for capital. Capital is going into North Dakota. Who would have said 10 years ago that North Dakota would be the fourth largest oil producer in the United States? That's where the money is going. The money is going into new oil developments in Texas, in Arkansas, gas, of course, developments. Ohio is now coming on as a major target for new investment. That's where money is going. Money is going into oil sands in Canada on a colossal scale. Oil sands currently are 1.5 million barrels a day. They're projected to be 4.5 million barrels a day 15 years from now. So, interestingly, Russia has now come on board with relatively attractive terms, and as you have heard, Exxon, BP, other major oil companies are now considering Russia a major target area. Brazil, with huge new discoveries in their deep water, is now a major target area. The main LNG competitor of Alaska is now Australia. Now, this is a massive change. All these nations have well-defined fiscal systems. If you go to Alberta and you ask what the terms for heavy oil are, they can tell you in 3 minutes. If you go to Australia and you ask what the terms for LNG gas are, they can tell you in 3 minutes. If you go to North Dakota, on state lands or federal lands, the terms are totally fixed. Anywhere in the U.S., the terms on federal and state lands are totally fixed. So investors now have massive, attractive opportunities in jurisdictions that have fixed fiscal terms. You don't need to negotiate anymore. You don't need to sit together with a government to come up with terms. The terms are decided. The terms are there. And all you have to do in Australia, if you want to launch an LNG project, no, find a buyer and launch one. That's it. If you want to do a heavy oil sand project in Alberta, all you need is a small little document to be signed with the minister that approves the project, and you're on the way. So here you see it is an entirely new competitive environment, an environment you're now competing with OECD, largely OECD countries, which have defined and very attractive fiscal terms. That's the new world Alaska lives in. And consequently, yes, please.
Well, just before you go to the next slide, I'll let you finish up this slide, but then please stop for questions. Are you Are you done with this slide?
Yes.
Okay. I just got a couple, and then we'll go to Senator Egan. I'd like you to define for those watching at home that aren't as familiar with this as we are, what conventional oil and unconventional oil is. A little more detail, please. And then I've got a quick follow-up on that.
Okay. Conventional oil and gas is oil and gas from the oil industry, from the oil business that we know it. That means if you want to do exploration, you drill exploration wells and you may find an oil field, or you may have a dry well, or to find a gas field, and then you define the field, and if the field is low cost enough and attractive enough under the fiscal system, then you will start producing it. So conventional oil and gas is oil and gas in reservoirs, in accumulations, in fields that you have to find with exploration, and consequently, depending on the level of exploration and the risk of exploration, you may find them and then develop. Unconventional oil and gas is largely found already. We know where shale oil is. Even in Alaska, we know where the shale oil is because it has been drilled already. Heavy oil and oil sands, we know where it is. It doesn't need to be discovered. Shale gas doesn't need to be discovered. We know where it is. The problems with unconventional oil or the unconventional oil production does not relate to exploring for it, relates to developing new technologies to produce those resources from reservoirs that have already been discovered. Or not reservoirs, I should not have even used the word reservoirs. If you take, for instance, the shale oil that may be present in the North Slope of Alaska, it is not located even in any reservoir. It is located in the original source rock from which oil was derived and immigrated towards, migrated to Prudhoe Bay. So consequently, conventional oil is oil that we know, sorry, unconventional oil, rather, is oil that we know where it is, but it takes new technology to produce it. And with the high oil prices, technology is now very rapidly developing to produce all these new unconventional oil resources that have already been discovered but need to be produced now. So that is the biggest difference between the two resources.
And then on slide 17, one area that you haven't covered, and that's the national oil companies' impact around the world and how that may or may not affect corporate behavior. And if you could tie in that issue over the last decade and a half from 97 to 12 and why we should pay attention or why we shouldn't pay attention to national oil companies' impacts.
Now, interestingly, the most amazing development over the last 15 years has not actually been with national oil companies. Interestingly, national oil companies used to exist, and with national oil companies, I mean 100% state-owned oil companies. And consequently, what we see is most of these 100% state-owned oil companies have particular roles in their home country, like Saudi Aramco, Pemex in Mexico. And those roles have not changed very much. What has changed, and that is an entirely new development that is also very important for Alaska, what has changed is that a new type of companies has emerged that I would call state-supported companies or state capital companies, like Petrobras, which officially is a private company, works like a private company, but works with massive support of its home government, the same as Gazprom, for instance, the Russian gas company. So new companies are emerging in the world that, and Statoil, for instance, that are national championship companies that work privately but actually have a state role and a state function and are state not supported with subsidies but are supported in many different ways by their own home countries, and that is an entirely new type of competitors that has emerged in the world. Now, that type of competitor may also be interested in developing Alaska resources because they go outside, they go outside the borders of their national territory to explore and develop, including the unconventional resources around the world. So this is a very interesting new development that also didn't really exist 15 years ago.
Okay, we'll have questions from Senator Thomas, and then we'll go to Senator French.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. You indicate on slide 17 that Australia is the main LNG competitor for Alaska, and we've concentrated on the southern states for quite some time now with even the AGEA concept. Will you cover later in your presentation how you think we stack up against Australia as far as competing with them with the close proximity to the Asia, anyhow, for the U.S.?
Yes, I will in great detail discuss that matter, say, in the afternoon.
Very good. Thank you.
Senator French.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Dr. Van Meers, fiscal stability is a theme that runs through your presentation, and I'm just looking at this slide 17 and looking at some of the folks who you are sort of attributing fiscal stability to, and I see the lower 48, I see Russia, I see Canada, but my understanding is that fiscal terms can change in all of those locations. Maybe you can tell me more about what sort of fiscal stability Texas and North Dakota offer. Maybe you can speak about Russia. I just read the newspaper, but it seems like about every 6 months you see a major blow-up in the terms of deals in Russia. I think of ConocoPhillips and the difficulty they had losing some of their assets to Russian nationalization. And furthermore, in Canada, it seems like in Alberta, they've changed the fiscal terms with some regularity. You may support the changes, and they may be good changes, but nevertheless, they do change. So can you just speak to the examples on this page and what sort of fiscal stability they offer?
Okay, that's a very important point. What I mention on this slide is that they have fixed and usually attractive terms, which means fixed means they tell what the terms are. They have, you can go to the government, and if you ask what are your terms, you can get a nice little booklet, and that is what their terms are. You are absolutely correct in stating that in the new competitors of Alaska, actually none of the competitors offers fiscal stability at this point in time, which was actually quite different from the jurisdictions that I mentioned 15 years ago. So that is an interesting change. Now, in many of these jurisdictions, investors are willing to invest without fiscal stability because they believe the governments of these jurisdictions will act reasonably. Now, in the case of Russia, there is a question mark on that issue. And, of course, companies that invest in Russia take great precaution in their deals to ensure that they are protected in case of significant fiscal change. Interestingly, though, if you look at Russia, the major changes in Russia has been lowering fiscal terms, not increasing fiscal terms.
Thank you.
Well, Senator Pasquin, then Senator Wagner.
Thank you, Mr. Van Meers. In the competitors of Alaska, you identify the lower 48, and I am assuming you're meaning a jurisdiction such as North Dakota. And certainly in North Dakota, if you're a sophisticated owner with a high-class resource, your royalty will be approximately 25% of the gross, and then the tax is a little bit north of 10%. Is that within the definition of fixed fiscal terms? And is that within your definition of attractive fiscal terms?
For shale gas, generally speaking, in North Dakota, the terms are about 60% government take, which is quite attractive if you compare that, say, to even conventional oil terms in Alaska. As you well know, probably in North Dakota or in most states of the United States, you have three classes of land: federal lands, state lands, and private lands. On the state lands and the federal lands, the royalties are fixed, so you know exactly what your royalties are. On the private lands, of course, you have to negotiate with the landowner. Once you have concluded, though, your lease with the landowner, those terms are fixed.
I think that was shale oil.
Sorry?
Misspoke at shale oil.
Oh, shale oil, yeah. I may have misspoken.
A follow-up?
In other words, those are fixed fiscal terms if you have a defined royalty and then the defined production tax as based upon percentages of the gross?
In most states of the lower 48, you have typically four fiscal components. You have the royalty. Of course, you have the corporate and sometimes state income tax. Then you have the severance taxes or production taxes, as it is called, which are levied by the state. And then you have property taxes, as you well know in Alaska here, which are levied by the municipalities. So you have these four levels of fiscal design, which actually are common in most of the states of the United States. And for all of those components, the terms are known.
Senator Wagner.
Yeah, Pedro. I guess one of Alaska's problems is we can't stay with the tax plan long enough to do our tax book. But going past that, what other systems are out there, if any, that are similar to our net system versus how many systems out there are figured on a gross tax system?
Now, of course, tomorrow I will go deeper in the design of the, you know, the fiscal terms. But broadly speaking, interestingly, the huge difference between Canada and the royalties in Canada and the United States is that in Canada, the royalties are typically based on formulas and often based, and in some provinces of Canada, based on net profits, while in the U.S., like you have it here also in Alaska, the royalties are based on a fixed number. So if you go to Australia, some of the taxes are very similar to the PPT here in Alaska. So in the competing jurisdictions, also in Brazil, you have a profit share that is somewhat similar to Alaska. So you will find among your competitors that have terms that are fixed on gross, as well as competitors that have terms based on profits, as Alaska has.
Thank you.
Seeing no other questions, we'll go to the next slide, please.
Of course, the project-by-project approach in Alaska is a lengthy process, and that is very unfortunate because gas is a very, very aggressive market. And I have had the honor, as I mentioned, to work for Governor Knowles as well as Governor Murkowski trying to get a gas project going. But the interesting part is the process. Under Governor Knowles, I remember very well when I started out, everybody very enthusiastic. And then the lengthy process started of trying to introduce and pass the Stranded Gas Development Act, after which negotiations had to take place and terms had to be approved in the legislature. Now, by the time the Stranded Gas Act was passed, Asian buyers had already found other clients, other suppliers. And consequently, the whole initiative, which looked very good to sell gas to Asia, kind of evaporated. The same thing happened with the big gas line. Governor Murkowski asked me to come in 2003, and I still remember very vividly that he said, Pedro, we have to present something to the legislature in 2004 because we have a very small window here. And it turned out that because of all kinds of internal opposition, it was dragged out, and after 4 years, this project did not go forward. So the process of doing things project by project in the new competitive world of Alaska just takes too long. And this is something that I think needs to be internalized, because the market is changing fast. Gas markets are changing very rapidly. Buyers are very fickle. Asian buyers in particular are very practical. If you want to sell gas to them, if you have it today, fine. If you don't, they don't listen to you. Like, you really have to be in there aggressively if you want to get a gas project going. And I think the lengthy process that Alaska has experienced so far, irrespective of the merits of rejection or not, just the length of the process is too long to really be an aggressive player in the new environment that Alaska is in.
Senator French, you have a question?
Thank you. Just a brief point, Mr. Chairman. On your second bullet point, you have the date of 2003 there, but none of us, including the public, saw anything of that project until 2006. So that's really when it kind of came to light. That's point one. Point two is, I don't know if it was a missed opportunity. When you look at the gas market right now in the lower 48, had we built that pipeline and started sending gas there, we'd be experiencing little or no profit whatsoever, and maybe even worse. I get your ultimate point, but folks watching shouldn't think, we missed the boat in 2003 because that would have been a disaster.
Interestingly, you're absolutely correct. The process, the negotiating process, was started in 2003. It lasted precisely until 2006 before it could be brought to the legislature, as you say, absolutely correct. The negotiating process was simply too slow to proceed to a quick deal. If the gas line had been approved in 2004, I mean, this line would have cost $14 billion. The tariff would have been, I still have my calculations, $1.25. You could even survive and visit $2.50 market today. Very interesting. Now, you wouldn't have made much money on it, and who knows if this may be happy for Alaska that this line didn't come, because now you may have a better opportunity in the Pacific. But if the gas prices go back up, then it is a major lost opportunity. There is no question.
Okay. Do you have other questions on this slide? Okay, next slide, please.
So what I believe Alaska needs to do, and I know how difficult it is and what a big policy change that is, but what I believe Alaska needs to do is you need to start competing with your competitors. And this means you have to start defining terms. Ideally, Alaska should produce is a "we are open for business" brochure, a nice 20-pager or a nice 30-pager, as so many other nations offer, and say to investors, these are our terms for light, existing light oil, these are our terms for new oil, these are our terms for heavy oil, these are our terms for ultra-heavy oil, this is for gas, this is for shale oil. And if you can distribute, and if you can put that on websites these days, investors from all over the world will look at that. And somebody in Dubai will say, hey, these terms for gas don't look bad. Maybe I should come up and look at this. And so consequently, but if you don't have any terms, if people cannot find out what your terms are, or if you have to come in and negotiate terms, then very little interest will exist in the current world, because there's more than enough opportunities today to invest in places where the terms are known and you don't have to figure it out. So I think Alaska should move really from a process where you negotiate deal by deal and then probably be too slow to actually be in the right time window, to a far more aggressive approach to present the state to the world and say, here it is, these are our terms. Now, what happened if nobody comes on those terms and you publish the book and no results? Is that waste of time? No, because now you have very valuable information about the market out there of investors. Now you know and you have hard proof of what investors are looking at. If you are successful, it is wonderful for Alaska. So I think this policy change is required.
If we could, before we jump to the next slide, Senator Hoffman, you have a question?
Nope.
Okay, just reading your body language. Next slide, I guess.
Okay, so now the I think with the implementation of light oil terms and for existing and new production, it seems to me that no particular other implementation measures have to be taken if you want to attract investors than simply publishing your terms. Most of the investment in existing and particular new oil is incremental, and consequently companies probably, if you have attractive terms for new, companies will probably respond positively to your terms. If you want to attract investment to major new light oil, or in this case, condensate investments like Point Thompson. I think, and if you want to attract major billion-dollar investments to heavy oil, shale oil, natural gas, or let alone GTL, I think you are back to fiscal stability. Now, you would ask me, why do you need fiscal stability in Alaska if you don't need it in Australia and in Alberta? The reason is the history of Alaska. Terms have changed here rather significantly over the last 15 years, and I think investors would be more concerned about changing terms than they would be in Alberta, Australia, or the lower 48s. So in order to overcome that concern, I think offering fiscal stability would be a good thing to do. The nice part of offering fiscal stability for Alaska is that fiscal stability in the North American legal concept would be very worthwhile. And actually, it will allow you to get better terms, I think, because fiscal stability would be very worthwhile. That means that you would have to have contractual relationships with respect to the big projects. Fiscal stability periods may be 10 to 25 years, depending on the nature of the contract and depending on the type of investment. And in exchange for offering fiscal stability, of course, what you would want to do is request significant investment, because that should be the goal for Alaska, to attract significant investment. And if with the lever of fiscal stability you can attract significant new projects, I think that will be very worthwhile for the state. I remember very well, of course, that fiscal stability, offering fiscal stability, is not necessarily a matter that is crystal clear legally. When the Alaska pipeline was discussed at the time, there was a lot of discussion about the legality of fiscal stability, and it is well known that the ultimate decision on this matter would have to be taken by the Alaska Supreme Court, whether it is even possible, of course, to offer that fiscal stability. But if it is possible, then it is a very valuable tool to attract enhanced investment under actually favorable terms. For Alaska, that is.
Senator French, you have a question?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Maybe more of a comment. Dr. Van Meers and I have been having this discussion about fiscal stability for, I think, 6 years now, and I guess it's worth it just to take a minute to remind him and the public about why we've been having this conversation, and it's because our Constitution is black and white clear about this. We can't do it absent a constitutional amendment. Here's what the Constitution says in Article 9, Section 1. It says the taxing power, the power of taxation, shall never be surrendered. This power shall not be suspended or contracted away, except as provided in this article. I've looked into this a lot. I know other people have as well. No one has yet to show me a path to even allowing the Supreme Court to grant fiscal stability of the type that you're speaking about, absent a constitutional amendment. So it's less about the Alaska Supreme Court deciding to offer fiscal stability and more a question of whether this body would pass a resolution to change the Constitution and the people of the state approving it. And I think that's just vanishingly small. I know you're a big proponent of this idea, but I just think it's politically unrealistic to expect it to ever happen. Thank you.
Yes, I'm not an expert on you know, political realism, of course, and I was well informed. Now, you probably also have listened to the various presentations about fiscal stability. It was my impression that there were well-informed lawyers on the government side which felt that it was possible. So this is a legal question. This is outside the scope of my expertise, of course. All I can say as an economist, that if you can offer it, it is a valuable tool to attract investment. That is all I can say. How political realistic.
Do you have any other questions on this slide? Well, next slide, please.
Okay. Another great difficulty in changing, say, the policies in Alaska is that the major producers are what you call in a harvesting mode. I mean, their goal today is to use the cash in Alaska to invest in more attractive opportunities abroad. Their goal, as you can easily see from the statistics, of the $100 per barrel they may reinvest $10 or $15 in Alaska, and that's about it, which is a very typical pattern if you are in what is called a harvesting mode, which means the major oil companies at this point in time clearly don't see major large projects left in Alaska that they would be interested in investing in. They see very attractive projects abroad, and consequently, they are in a process of drawing cash out of Alaska to invest abroad. If they would have sustained interest in Alaska, they would not be reinvesting $10 or $15 per barrel. They would be investing $50 per barrel. So you're talking an order of magnitude 3 difference here. So the fact that they are in an harvesting mode is normal. That is what oil companies are at the end of the life when everything feels mature. But because they're all in a pattern of essentially using the income from Alaska in other countries in the world, it will be difficult, as also Senator Wagner already indicated, it will be difficult to kind of get a new environment in which the three major oil companies, which can make such a large contribution to this state, will reassess the state and say, no, maybe we should start spending again significant new cash in Alaska. So I see a major obstacle in trying to reverse that overall trend.
Before you go to the next slide, Dr. Van Meers, the harvest mode discussion, how long in your opinion or estimation has the three majors been in this harvest mode? Is this just a recent thing that started last month, or has it been going on for a while?
This is now a harvesting mode, you know, essentially in terms of investor behavior. You always have kind of three phases in a new petroleum basin. First, you have the investment mode period, where companies bring in capital, and if they are already producing, they reinvest all their savings in the same jurisdiction and bring in new capital in the new jurisdiction. That is kind of investment mode. Then you can be in a sustained presence mode, whereby you reinvest most of your cash into the same jurisdiction, in the case of Alaska, for instance, $50 per barrel, and only take modest share of the profits out. And then you have the harvesting mode, where you only reinvest a small amount of your income in the case of, because now the developments in the jurisdiction are so mature and the opportunities are so little that far more attractive opportunities exist abroad. Now, the oil industry has been a long time in a harvesting mode in Alaska. This is not the last months. This has been going on for a long time. In fact, the whole reason that originally the PPT was introduced by Governor Murkowski at the time in 2006 was indeed to try to make Alaska more attractive and try to reverse some of that harvesting mode. So I think these companies have been in that mode for a long time already.
Okay. Senator Wagner, did you have a question?
Yes.
Okay. Senator Pascoe.
Is the corporate philosophy as far as harvesting mode influenced in any way in the likelihood or probability of not finding billion barrel or greater reservoirs?
Of course, I should maybe move to the next slide because I answered that very question in the next slide. I do believe that certainly there is still possibilities in Alaska for investment, even for new light oil. I mean, let's not talk about heavy oil. There definitely are still possibilities for new light oil. My own estimate, but that's a back-on-the-envelope estimate, is that there could still be about a billion barrels, to be produced of new light oil. And what does that consist of now? The USGS estimates that there could be maybe 3 billion barrels of undiscovered oil. Usually a percentage of that is discovered in the next decade, so maybe 100, 200, 300 million barrels of light oil could still be discovered. There are a number of discovered fields actually laying around that have not been connected to the network, and with better terms, they may be connected. And also the companies are doing the so-called infill drilling. Now the infill drilling, of course, the main objective of infill drilling is to extract the oil faster, but typically this infill drilling, you would also increase the recovery factor in the reservoir, and that may also yield a few hundred million barrels. So I do believe that as a minimum there is still another billion barrels of new oil left. However, if and companies are already infill drilling because that is a profitable activity under current situation, although it could be made more profitable with new terms, major oil companies are probably not interested in exploring for the last remaining small fields and probably not interested in connecting very small fields that are left unless there are better terms. So I cannot see much to invest in Alaska for the major oil companies if the terms remain the way they are.
Follow up?
Is Alaska in a transition from where it was in only the three majors universe to where the three majors will remain, but we will have more and more independents and other world majors coming to Alaska? Are we in a transition time?
Yes, it is very normal for if you mature your petroleum production to gradually attract a new group of companies, typically smaller companies that are looking at the smaller objectives. For instance, Norway has a specific policy today to attract smaller companies because they feel in the British North Sea, in the Norwegian North Sea, they are now at the smaller fields. Britain has attractive terms for smaller companies, special allowances for the smaller fields to attract the smaller companies. They have special uplifts for newcomers. So if you get towards the end of the life of your oil history, like Norway, like Britain, like Alaska, at least conventional light oil history, then it is very normal to start to attract a whole new style of oil companies, smaller companies interested in smaller fields, smaller targets, and that is entirely normal, and I think that's what Alaska should do. That doesn't mean that large investment by the major oil companies will continue to be very valuable if you can stimulate them to do so, but it is at the same time very logical to start looking at a new group of investors.
I think this is the last slide this morning. I think the next slide we call it the International Competitive Framework. We have a little bit of time left if we have any other questions for Dr. Van Meers concerning this morning's presentation. If not, we're going to fire up a one. Senator Hoffman.
Yes, can we revert to slide number 20? Regarding Point Thompson, you know, the industry says that they're not ready for heavy oil, and how can Alaska be more aggressive with the company in the area of changing the terms so that we are more proactive in trying to get those 5 billion barrels of oil produced?
No, that is a very important question, and what I'd like to do tomorrow morning is give you detailed strategy tomorrow afternoon, a detailed strategy of the exact terms that I think will do that precisely, so that you have an idea of what you could do in Alaska. This is my recommendation, of course, what you could do in Alaska to achieve the goal of the governor and to achieve the development of these resources.
We have another question over here.
Just briefly. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Will you also then be discussing, as you mentioned on slide 21, commitments to substantive work programs as well as maybe lease terms and things like that within your presentation over the next couple of days?
You refer to other lease terms than fiscal terms?
Lease terms as well as what you consider substantive work programs for specifically to the state of Alaska.
I will not address the issue of substantive work programs because this is a broad policy change. It is not a targeted change. But the broad concept is to say if we offer fiscal stability subject to the comments Senator French was made as far as, the uncertainty surrounding fiscal stability at this point in time. If you could offer fiscal stability, then that would be a very attractive way to attract work commitments. In most nations, work commitments would be commitments. This is not small commitments. You're not talking about a few million here, a few million there. These are billion-dollar commitments. Typically, the commitments are structured in phases, say a first, second, third phase where you have to commit to. Typically, the second and third phases are conditional on certain results being obtained in the first phase. So for a heavy oil project and for a shale oil project and for a natural gas project, how you would structure those work commitments and how you would phase those work commitments would be quite different. But the broad concept would be the same. Tomorrow, I will mainly concentrate on the fiscal terms that would have to be offered.
Thank you.
Okay. Senator Pascal.
Just a follow-up on slide 21 that you're at right now. When it comes to fiscal stability in their terms, you focus here on the substantive work program. Is there a reason why there wouldn't be an inherent focus on the production as compared to the amount of the investment? In other words, it seems like, for example, under either PPT or ACES, we've had over $4 billion worth of investment that the state of Alaska has made in its Central North Slope region, and that $4-plus billion, we're still seeing the declining throughput. Mm-hmm. So when it comes to fiscal stability, should the focus be on production as compared to just amount of investment?
The work program in a number of nations is being defined in different ways. In some contracts around the world, that literally says you shall achieve so many barrels, per day. Or it is not defined how much you have to invest. The goal is a particular level of production. And if you don't reach that level, then there are penalties and other things in the contract. So you can, the work program can be defined in the production level to be achieved or in the amount of capital to be invested or both. So there are different styles of work program in the world. And for different style projects, it would be logical to use different style work programs.
We'd like the record to reflect that Senator Welikowski joined us a few minutes ago. Do we have any final comments for Dr. Van Meers this morning? Okay, we're going to go ahead and adjourn. We'll reconvene at 1 o'clock for the second part of the four-part series.
We are.
Is that? No, I think we're adjourned. Adjourned. Correct? Yes, we're adjourned. Because we have a
good afternoon. We'll call the Senate Resources Committee meeting to order this February 13th, 2012. Let the record reflect that the time is approximately 3:37 p.m. on this afternoon. We do have a quorum present, co-chair Senator Wagner, Senator Stedman, Senator Stevens, Senator French, Senator Welikowski, and myself, Senator Pasquin. We have two items actually on the agenda today. The commissioner will finish the presentation that they began on Friday titled Defining the Problem. The second presentation by the commissioner will be a 5-year look back and oil industry capital expenditures by category presentation. Ironically, we will not be hearing the Department of Revenue presentation called Access to Information. So I understand maybe we'll get your reason why that is not there. But anyway, We then at 5 p.m. Will be hearing Senator Seaton's bill, the GUI duck bill, and we will hear that at approximately 5 p.m. This afternoon once the Department of Revenue's presentation is complete. We do have in the audience with us Senator Giesel. I do not see any other elected officials, but given that...
Representative Seaton is here.
Hmm? Representative Seaton is here. All right, thank you. With that, Commissioner...
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Brian Butcher, Commissioner of the Department of Revenue. I apologize for being a few minutes late. The department's been spread a little thin this afternoon, and, but I'm here now and ready to go.
No, we did understand, Commissioner, that you are just coming out of another hearing, so we wanted to give you a few minutes so you could collect your thoughts and get a little organized. So given that we were in the defining the problem yesterday, and you know, before we get started on that current slide, you know, I believe some information may have been provided to you regarding your slide 6 and some of the forward-looking capital expenditures.
Yes.
And essentially, was there a slide prepared including that forward information?
Mr. Chairman, Bruce Tangeman, I hate to pass the buck, but he was the one working on this today, and he is not here yet, so I don't have the answer to that, unfortunately. But when he gets here, he may have the answer to that. If we don't have it today, we'll get it to you as soon as we can. And Mr. Chairman, in response to the slide deck on more information, we've been working with the Department of Law on what is appropriate and inappropriate to discuss in terms of the Gleason decision and other things, because it's an ongoing case, and we had something prepared that they had some concerns about. So we're working back and forth on it, and we'll have something for the committee certainly in the future. It's just apparently not ready for prime time today. Taking a look at the progressivity problem, slide 13 is a bar chart that compares ELF in the dark blue to PPT, in the light blue to ACES, in the light orange to ACES. That was ACES is introduced in the light orange, and then ACES is passed in the reddish orange. And we believe that the pendulum has swung too far in terms of the progressivity, that certainly ELF was not getting the state its fair share of taxes and definitely needed to be reformed. That then occurred with PPT, and then, as you can see, ACES as proposed would have brought in a little bit more, but that ACES as passed brought in considerably more. And to give you kind of an idea of where the governor's oil tax bill sits on this, if we added a bar chart for that, it would be close to the ACES as proposed. So we'd still be looking at a quite a high progressive tax. It just wouldn't be as high as we're looking at currently with ACES.
Senator Stedman has a question.
Mr. Chairman, maybe just as a brief explanation for those at home, and then make sure we're cued in. I take it these numerics are out of the fall revenue source book with the price of oil at $109.47 and the volume expectations of 555,000 barrels a day. And these the years following are off of your expectations.
Yes, through the chair, Senator Stedman, that's correct. I should have pointed that out. These are based on the production and price forecasts of the fall 11 Department of Revenue forecast, and therefore the next four fiscal years, 13, 14, 15, and 16, based on those forecasts.
And then if I could, Mr. Chairman, I assume the capital expenditures that you need for the deduction the immediate write-off of the capital expenditures and the credits attained with the capital expenditures are all derived off of the forward-looking information submitted to the department. Is that correct?
Through the chair, yes, understood.
And then I assume Mr. Chairman will be getting that data at some form. I know the other day we asked for updated charts because we're looking at 11 and backwards, I think, as I recall. We wanted to look at 13 forward also on the same graphical presentation because there was a difference in the verbal presentation versus the documents in the revenue source book. And apparently the difference here matches up with the source book information, but it doesn't match up with the verbal testimony Friday.
Through the chair, Senator Steadman, that's information we'll be getting for you, and I think you're referring to the updated information, the updated expenditure information in the current fiscal year. Is that the verbal information you're referencing?
Right. Well, if I could, Mr. Chairman, I think the testimony in Friday was that we expect capital expenditures to decline. Yet in the revenue source book, they're increasing. The answer to a question I think that Senator Pascavan sent off and got back shows the expenditures in FY15 capital expenditures to go to almost $3.9 billion. These charts here represent the $3.9 billion in FY15, but it doesn't match up with the verbal testimony Friday, so we need to, in my opinion, flush out some of these details because we can't say on one hand capital expenditures are going down and then the next set of documents show it's going up.
Through the chair, Senator Steadman, we will be preparing that request. I think the point that we were trying to make was that the forecast is for capital expenditures to go up, but it appears based on the last year and the current fiscal year that we've been overly optimistic in our forecast. And not to say that it invalidates our future forecast, because we don't believe that it does, but it is an interesting snapshot to take a look at.
Just one quick follow-up, Mr. Chairman. We can deal with this in more detail in the future, but there's tables that have been presented in a written response, and where you can see where, like, FY13's first capital expenditures back in fall of 08 were $3.1 billion, as an example. And then you can see the numerics move around as we went from fall to the spring forecast to the fall forecast all the way up to the fall 2011. So if there is a substantial deviation from expectations, we need to flush that out, because it doesn't appear that way looking at the data. And in the appropriation cycle, we need to know that in preparation for the call on the Treasury.
Through the chair, Senator Steadman, I agree with that.
Senator Wilkowski had a question.
Thank you. Yeah, just
I would welcome Deputy Commissioner Tangeman, and you're welcome to come forward. You've already been used as an excuse once, so we want to check that. Welcome, Deputy Commissioner Tangeman, to Senate Resources. Anyway, Senator Wilkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Yeah, just to reiterate what Senator Steadman said, I think it would be very helpful for us to have the information about what was being forecast and then what actually happened, and if it came in lower, the reasoning why. Was it permit backlogs? Was it, in fact, because of ACEs? If we could get specific fields, that'd be very helpful. But also on this current chart that you have here, when just going back over some old testimony, you just testified you want to see the tax rate lowered to roughly where ACES is proposed, and just going back and looking at prior testimony, the industry opposed PPT. The industry opposed ACES as proposed. So what makes you think that now the industry will significantly increase their investment when they've testified in the past that going to the level you want to go to was not a good level, was still too high?
through the chair, Senator Wilikowski. Two parts to the answer. Number one, this is one piece of the bill that was introduced. This isn't the entire bill that was introduced. And the second piece of it is, after we rolled out the bill and dropped it in, we talked to the companies, and they all thought that it would make a material difference. They all saw, not literally to a company, but most of the companies we talked to said that it would make a material difference and that it would result in more investment in Alaska as a result of passage. And they could give you a better idea of their read on it compared with the past than we could.
And if I could add one thing, again, I apologize for being late. I was testifying on another governor's bill. Through the chair, Senator Wilikowski, I think taking testimony from several years back and trying to apply it to today is a little dangerous, because I think the oil price is the overriding part of the discussion. Back then, we were looking at, top ends of $80 or, in that ballpark. I don't think we were necessarily envisioning the high sustained oil prices that we have today. That jump in oil price is obviously making certain development more economic. So saying what they said, use what they said last year or 5 years ago in this discussion, I think we need to look at the current actual information we have in front of us. And what we know now is that oil has been at triple digits for several months now, at a sustained period. So it's new information, I think, that would probably change the conversation.
Senator Stedman.
Just because we're on the record making a record of this, I think if we went back and looked at the testimony when we did ACES, you would find that we spent quite a bit of time in the high price environment, and to the point where, as I recall, Senator French had a change in the slope that needed to be bent a little bit, and I helped him with the math of that, even though I didn't support his position. So I don't think the record's going to match what you just said. We spent quite a bit of time in high price environments. This was a direct policy call.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Stedman, I think there's a difference between having hypothetical discussions about high oil prices and actually living and making capital investment decisions in a high oil price environment. I know that that's not directly answering what Mr. Tangeman said, but I think it's a different world the decisions are being made in, and I would imagine companies are looking at things a little differently than they did 3, 4, 5 years ago.
And I would also add that if we were looking at the effects on a tax on Alaska at high oil prices, that's certainly a discussion to have. But I think the important part is to see what this high oil price, what the effect has had elsewhere. And that's what's driving the boom in our competition's backyard, and I think that's as important a part of this discussion as what the government take would be for Alaska.
Senator French has a question.
Thank you, and let me change gears a little bit and ask, in your efforts to address competitiveness, have you seen any increase in applications for royalty relief? And I'm glad that Dr. Van Meers is here, because maybe in his presentation tomorrow he can talk to us about how royalty relief might provide an increase in competitiveness without having to go through several different adjustments or having several different schedules for different tax rates on different types of oil on our books. Royalty relief is on the books. It's there to help make non-competitive or non-economic developments economic. If it's true that there's a lot of development out there that would happen if we lowered oil taxes, why wouldn't it happen if we got royalty relief? And are you seeing any increase in those applications?
Through the chair, Senator French, royalty relief is certainly a lever that can be used. It's certainly something that can be of benefit to the state. However, when we're looking at changing our tax structure something that anybody, any company that wanted to read or keep up on what was going on in Alaska could read, could understand, could make decisions on if they wanted to bid on leases. That, to me, is going to make a much bigger difference in potentially companies and investments that might come in than royalty relief that, although a positive lever, can only occur when somebody has a lease, has explored, has gathered enough information to actually lay everything out to the Department of Natural Resources with an explanation of what would need to happen to make it economic. Basically, something that's close to economic, but not quite. A tremendous amount of money, an expense, has to go into a company getting to that point. That being said, it's only been utilized a few times in our state's history. Now, I don't work for the Department of Natural Resources. I have no insight into should they get more applications? Do they get more applications, or what that particular situation is? But it's certainly something that would result in millions of dollars of spend to get to, as opposed to a change in tax, which is something that would be readily apparent to the entire world.
And I'd also like to add, this is more the other side of the house for the department, but I believe the amount of royalty directly affects the amount of money that's going into the permanent fund. And if we have a choice, I would certainly rather be looking at the tax and the effect it would have on the state coffers as opposed to the amount of money that's going into the permanent fund. If you're reducing royalty, you're reducing the amount that's going into the permanent fund, that has a direct impact on everybody's permanent fund check.
Follow up. I'm very sensitive about the permanent fund, and I'm glad that you are as well. But don't you think there should be some proof offered? Did you listen to the presentations we heard from Mr. Brennan and others who said, you know, you should be very, very cautious about not paying someone to do something they're already going to do? And if we want to get 1 million barrels of pipeline in the oil in the next 10 years, many of those projects are already in development now. They're under lease now. They're not people who are just going to open the newspaper tomorrow and say, oh, there's been a tax reduction in Alaska. Let's get started on something. And so my concern is that we try to make projects that are not economic now economic through an adjustment to the tax system. And that's difficult in the absence of evidence from the industry, evidence that I think they're going to withhold. I don't think they're going to come forward and tell us what projects are being held back right now by ACES, projects that they would go forward with if we granted them the tax reduction. And so royalty relief seems to be the place where you test through evidence their desire to reduce the state take. And so if we're not seeing an increase in those applications, that's a signal, at least to me, about the lay of the economic land. Thank you.
If I may, Commissioner, slide 13, and for example, with the year 2013, that's representing a split of PTV. Is that correct? In other words, the red is at 4.7, that corresponds with revenue source book split of PTV?
Yes, Mr. Chairman.
All right. So if you were to put a bar to the right side of that red bar, the oil industry's split would be $7.7 billion?
Through the chair, Senator Passman, it's not quite that simple. Again, this is a snapshot of a projection.
Well, except for if I may, just so that we're laying the proper, you know, on looking at FY13, your production tax estimate, and I'm looking at your $4.7 billion split for the state of PTV, and that's exactly, as I understand it, where in 2013 you put the red bar. So if we're dividing up the 12.385 billion dollars, that means approximately $7.7 billion is industry's bar, if there was a bar to the immediate right of that red bar representing the oil industry split of PTV. Is that correct?
Through the chair, Senator Passman, I believe there's also federal tax implications that would have to be paid off through that $7 billion.
I'm just talking about split of PTV. Senator Stedman has a question.
No, I was just, Mr. Chairman, I was just
going to mention that there's only three players at the table, the sovereign, which is us, the industry, we all know who those three are, and then the federal government, we know who they are. So that split has to be, whatever money's left over has to be split between the federal government and the industry at something substantially less than the 35% federal rate, whatever that rate is, their effective rate.
Through the chair, Senator Stedman, to follow up on this. This is production tax only, so there's also property tax, corporate income tax, federal tax.
No, I understand that. In other words, you are setting forth a figure for 2013 that is a figure derived from the split of production tax value under our production tax system.
Right.
Okay, and all I am is making the comment is based upon the split of that $12,385,000,000, then industry has approximately $7.7 billion. That would be their bar on this same chart.
Correct. Okay. Before their other taxes are backed up.
And again, without getting involved in, I understand the analysis of, anyway, Senator Wilkowski is.
Yeah, well, just to clarify, last year, my understanding is ConocoPhillips made roughly $2 billion. BP made roughly the same. And Exxon, as roughly a third, 35% owner, we don't know what they made, but is it fair to say they made probably the same? And as I calculate profits, it's about $6 billion in sheer profit per just last year, and over $30 billion in profits since we passed ACES. Is that, do those numbers show what your numbers show, roughly?
I'd like to invite our assistant chief economist up to help set us straight a little bit, if that's okay.
Mr. Stickel, I believe is the correct pronunciation. If I'm mispronouncing that, please let me know.
Sure. For the record, my name is Dan Stickel, acting assistant chief economist for the Department of Revenue. And when you're looking at what the question of what is the share remaining to the producers of the total production tax value, Bruce is correct that it's not as simple as taking production tax value and subtracting out your production tax liability. When we're looking at the income statements in Appendix D of the Revenue Sources book, you're correct that the production tax value shown is after royalty. And to derive the producer take out of that production tax value number, you're going to have to subtract out the production tax as well as state corporate income taxes, state property taxes, to get the total state share, and then also federal corporate income taxes would come out before determining the remaining producer share. And we'd be happy to prepare that for you for 13.
In other words, is it a fair statement for the public to understand is that this is a complex issue?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, it is.
Right. And just so that it's understood, it's not just complex on the oil industry side, it's complex on the state side of the equation as well. Is that a fair statement to make?
That is correct. And in preparing this particular chart, the state corporate income tax and state royalties, there were not major changes. So this looks at the change in the one piece that did have significant changes from the time from ELF to BPT to ACES.
And part of the complexity, for example, in in the 2013 chart on that $4.7 billion for the state, coming out of that, so to speak, in a general revenue sense, is at least $400 million in additional credits that has to be paid out by the state. That's part of the complexity.
That's correct.
Thank you. And actually, if you could return to slide 10, and just real quickly, one of the points that I think we were trying to get to last Friday, you know, the analysis was performed based upon $27. Isn't it true that if you applied FY13 hypotheticals, or you know what we anticipate the most realistic current information, that that 29 is less than 21? In other words, if you have an additional using those,
Mr. Chairman, we would need to take a look at the numbers and get back to you on that. We don't know it off the top of our head.
In other words, I think it reduces, you know, I think we're in agreement that the PTV used in your slide is based upon a 73 PTV. If you reduce it to under 63 because of the additional transportation costs, the additional OPEX, and then with the credit because of the higher CAPEX that's used in the revenue source book fall 2011, I'd welcome the analysis because I think you're going to see that it's markedly different than the 29. Senator Stedman?
Mr. Chairman, just to follow up on that, I think it'd be helpful. I pity the public at home watching the conversation the last few minutes because these terms we're used to, but they're abstract, I think, in the general public, and they could be measured in several ways. So it might be beneficial, Mr. Chairman, if they convert it, not only adjust for the conversation that you're having and requesting, but put it in dollar throughput for the entire year. So we see it not in per barrel, so we have to worry about per barrel if it's before net of royalties. But we look at just total dollars and we start measuring it in cash flow because it's much harder to manipulate and it's easier for us to see if there is areas in our system that need to be adjusted more than not.
Through the chair, Senator Stedman, absolutely. This was attempting to make a as simple of an illustration as you can, and you can see the complexity and the amount of time we spent on this alone. So as we add more layers to this onion, it certainly adds to the complexity and that definitely more in-depth analysis to lay it out, but that's certainly where we'll be going. Slide 14 is a look at the marginal take under the current tax system. There's obviously been confusion in the different ways to look at the government take. This is the marginal take, which is the take of an additional dollar as the price of a barrel goes up. So at ANS, prices over $78, marginal government take is over 75%. This means that government takes at least 75% of each additional dollar of profit a company can produce.
Mr. Chairman, go ahead.
Senator French, then Senator Stedman.
Might be the same point. I don't know. Is this PTV or is this net? Is this PTV or is this base?
Through the chair, Senator French, this is ANS West Coast. Price per barrel.
So you're saying at $30 a barrel, if you back out $25 worth of OPEX and CAPEX, leaving $5 of profit, that is taxed 60%?
No, I think the easiest way to look at it is if you look at $120 a barrel and you back out this, we go with approximately $30 or so. $92.50 PTV is where the 0.4 goes to 0.1. So about approximately $120 a barrel, you can see it dip down. So that's where the 0.1 would kick in.
Start over here at $30 and walk me through how that works.
Sure, Senator French through the chair. The calculation here is looking at, you start with your total value, your destination value for the oil and the oil that you sold. You back out your transportation costs, you back out your lease expenditures, and that gives you your divisible income.
So this is not base price, this is PTV. This is subtracting OPEX, CAPEX, and transportation.
Right. This shows the share of divisible income. However, the the x-axis is West Coast price. And so I think the point that Deputy Commissioner Tangen was making is that when you see these charts, sometimes the x-axis is shown in terms of West Coast price, sometimes it's shown in terms of production tax value, and this is based on a West Coast price.
Okay. And it's, and at $30, after you subtract OPEX, CAPEX, and transportation, the marginal government take is 60%?
Correct, Senator French, through the chair. So when you go from $30 to $31 of that $1 of additional divisible income, royalties, production tax, state corporate income tax would make up about 60% of that additional dollar.
Thank you.
Senator Stedman had a question than I.
No, go ahead, if you're, because mine's a little bit different. If you,
I read this chart to be a PTV chart because I'm looking at the $27, $26 transportation costs and $20 a barrel upstream costs, and it looks like that is where you get to 30. So then you take the base from 30 to 60. That's your base 25%, correct? And then you're adding the 92.50 on top of that. So I translated that to roughly just under $150 ANS crude pricing, approximately $120 PTV, just as rough estimates. So that's what I was looking at this chart to represent. Is that a...
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, that is correct. You would be at $92.50, that is about a little over $120 price. Taking it from
PTV,
PTV, which is what the line is based on, to the West Coast price, so you can better understand where the price would have to be. I think there's always a lot of confusion in determining the difference between PTV and the price of oil, you know, where even information that we've presented, people see that it's at $120 and they say, well, that must mean it's here. Well, no, that's not what it means. It's $120 PTV is what gets it up to kind of the peak in terms of marginal.
Senator Wilikowski.
Well, if I could shift it a little bit, just peeking forward, you know, your presentation. We've had a lot of discussion on the marginal government take issue. I see little in here on the effective tax rate. And do they pay their marginal rate or do they pay their effective tax rate? And when does, when do you use marginal, when do you use effective? And why should we have marginal here and not effective?
Through the chair, Senator Stedman, obviously they pay effective. Marginal is also important. Is it as important? No. But these are some of the things that are talked about when companies speak specifically to what's been going on with progressivity at the high cost of oil. So there's certainly both things we need to take a look at. We were asked to focus specifically on what the problem is, so we're focusing more specifically on progressivity, the high price, and what happens at the marginal price or the marginal percent when it's at high prices. We could put, and we have put, 40 and 50 page slides together in other committees and a little bit in this committee dealing with all of those various things, certainly including effective, because obviously that's very important as well.
Mr. Chairman, I
follow.
Yeah, I would like to see some information on the effective rate. I think if you look around the communities and the conversation, the presentations are given talking about marginal rates. The average guy on the street doesn't equate, I don't think, the difference between effective and marginal, particularly when it's delivered as the government or the tax imposed by the state on the industry. They assume that we're taking 90% of every dollar. So I think there's a lot of clarity we need to shine on the subject matter to not only make it explicitly clear here at the table, but for the public to understand what we're dealing with, because we don't have a 90% effective tax rate.
That is correct. Through the chair, Senator Stedman, that is correct. At high oil prices, that well, you certainly understand the issue. And they're both things that need to be discussed. But like I said, in trying to keep it to what the problem is in a fairly small number of slides, we're not giving nearly as comprehensive a presentation as we would normally be giving.
And Commissioner, I would also think it would be more appropriate in your slides, and I do think we do need the effective tax rate presentation, but as far as your premise to use the FY13, because that's kind of what we're working with right now, you know, certainly the finance people are looking at the FY13 budget issues, and the cumulative transportation and OPEX and CAPEX are 37.67 as compared to your 26, and so then that pushes that analysis, you know, higher up the x-axis. So I think it'd be more appropriate to use numbers that we're looking at for FY13. Is that reasonable?
That's a reasonable point. As we go to FY13, it becomes a projection more than actuals that we have for previous years or halfway through fiscal year 12. So it can be shown either way. It just depends on how you want to look at it.
Senator Wilikowski.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. And I was going to ask about effective rate, too. I think my recollection is $100 a barrel. The effective tax rate's around 28%. But I'm just curious to hear your take. Do you think having a higher marginal tax rate is at all a good policy call? And let me ask it in this context. If you look at Norway, the first dollar of profit, they spike up the tax rate 78%. And we could have done that. We chose not to. We chose to have a lower tax rate at lower dollars and then stair-step it up as profits went up. The oil companies made more. We made more. And because what was happening was, and we had a lot of discussion about this, what was happening was the oil companies were in harvest mode. We've heard that from Dr. Van Meers. They were making huge amounts of money but investing that elsewhere. And the concept behind the high marginal tax rate was to say if you reinvest that in the state of Alaska, we're going to give you what amounts to a very large tax break because you save that extra dollar. Your effective tax rate remains at $100 a barrel, 28%. But the marginal tax rate, the philosophy was it would encourage reinvestment in the state. We've seen since we passed ACES record reinvestment levels every single year. Do you think there's any merit to having a higher marginal tax rate? Or do you think... I guess I'll just leave it at that.
Through the chair, Senator Wilikowski, I think it makes sense. Progressivity makes sense to have the state share in a higher percentage of profits at high oil prices. I think, and the governor does as well, that this is too high, and that progressivity is something that is important to keep in place, just not to the more extreme level that it is today.
Seeing no further questions, please continue, Commissioner.
Slide 15 shows the share of profit oil between the federal government, the state, and the producer. And this clearly lays out what the problem is. We show the upper end of the price of oil being taken away as an incentive for companies to invest here. And that's what the issue comes down to. And again, this is looking at Alaska. We need to look at Alaska, and we also need to stack it up against what companies are looking at. And they're looking at other oil producing jurisdictions and where they can invest their dollars. And I think this is where it becomes punitive in Alaska compared to other jurisdictions.
Senator Stedman.
If I could recap the argument back when we did PPT, initially progressivity didn't exist. And the argument was you should be happy, state. Your dollars are going up. And when prices advanced and we had respond, some of us in the legislature, but we're not happy because our percent of the pie is going down. And what you're showing here is just in reverse, where instead of the state's percent of the pie going down, the industry's percent of the pie is going down. So I think we've both been in that situation that the industry finds themselves currently in. So I understand what their concern is. But I would like to, I do remember they weren't concerned when the state was concerned about it. And we drove that progressivity issue, the legislature did, and Governor Murkowski supported it in the end. I don't think he ever supported it, other than he signed the bill. But with that statement, Mr. Chairman, I would like to try to have these charts synchronized, because as we go into the next discussion, this one here talks about ANS West Coast in percentages. It would be nice to have the ANS West Coast in dollars, because when you flip to the next side, you're going to production tax value, which deletes out royalties and expenditures. So it gets kind of distorted, and the x-axis would be nice if they lined up, so we could see the issue of the percentage changes and then the dollar changes. Because if you're not used to watching your x-axis and making these mental adjustments, it makes it difficult for a lot of people.
Senator Wilikowski has a question.
Thank you.
And Commissioner Beef, is that acceptable?
Through this chair, Senator Stedman, we can do that.
Thank you, Senator Wilikowski.
Thank you. My understanding is that under ELF, the state would actually do better under ELF if the price of oil dropped below, say, $50 or so. There is a crossover point at some point. What we did with ACES was the bill originally had a gross minimum, or a minimum floor. As you recall, the oil companies said they didn't like that. We took that out. And the bargain was we were going to take out our protection at the low end, but we wanted to get more at the high end. Oil's $120, $118 a barrel. We have no idea if we have no idea if oil's going to stay this high. Oil could spike back down to $50, $60. We just have no idea where it's going to be. But my question for you is, at what point, you said at some point it becomes punitive to the oil industry. At what point is it punitive? Is it 33%? Is it 28%? Is it 25%? What share is unfair to the oil industry?
Through the chair, Senator Wilikowski, I don't think there's a specific spot. I think companies are different, and I think you'd hear them testify differently. I think that you look at, say, the governor's bill as drafted, to some companies, probably looks good. To some companies, looks okay, not that great. Some companies, maybe not so great. Everybody's got a different view of it. I think what I take from this slide is not just that the state is increasing as the price of oil goes up and the companies are decreasing, as much as the size of the state take as it increases and the size of the company take.
And Commissioner, I think it's also important for the public to remember that whatever the numbers may be, Alaska has to approach this problem kind of wearing two different hats. We wear the hat as the resource owner, and then we also wear the hat as a taxing jurisdiction. And I think that when it comes to analyzing what Alaska's appropriate value that it receives as an owner of the resource is one method of starting this approach, and then looking at the split when we address our role as a taxing entity. And so when one looks at, for example, royalties in other jurisdictions in the United States, where our royalty is 50% or less than what we assume are sophisticated owners of a class resource are receiving. So I think we can't just lump our hat as a resource owner and our hat as a taxing entity, and we can get confused.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I think that you're correct that we are the resource owner and we get royalties as a result. When a company is looking at their economic model in Alaska or someplace else, they're factoring into the royalties they're going to pay, whether it's to the state or the private landholder. It all factors into the economic model the same. So, I mean, when they're looking at $115 a barrel, 72% going to the federal government, the state government, that would be different in a different state or a different province, but they'd still be factoring that into their economic model. And we're trying to give a view of what a company might be looking at more than breaking out every piece of what the state gets and trying to define separately whether it's too high, whether it's too low, whether it's just right.
Slide 16 looks at the profits in dollars instead of percentages like on the previous slide. And I think this is an interesting way. We haven't really presented this in this committee before, but it's an interesting way to look at the small growth that the producer would realize at higher prices. Again, this is a way to show that the upside is clearly being realized by the state and the producer upside is minimal in comparison. And it's similar to the previous slide, just a dollar representation.
I guess the question, does this include credit deduction or limited credit deduction?
Mr. Chairman, this slide assumes 20% of capital expenditures are available for credit, and the entire amount is reflected in this snapshot illustration.
So another way of saying it, we have a 40%, for example, expiration capital credits, and then is it only the 20% for capital credits to operators with production, or does it include capital expenditures that can be obtained in cash from the state?
Right, and this illustration only looks at the 20% capital expenditure credit, and it does take off the entire 20%. For this illustration, we don't make a distinction between refunded capital credits versus applied against tax liability. They're all taken off the tax liability.
Senator Wilkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I keep hearing people say, I've heard the administration say, others say, well, when we did ACEs, the price of oil was, I don't know, $80 a barrel. No one expected these high prices, which sort of implies that you believe that others believe that ACEs works at certain levels but doesn't work at higher levels. And I guess that's what I'm trying to get at from you. I mean, at what point is ACEs broke? At what point is the share no longer fair? In the administration's opinion?
Through the chair, Senator Wilkowski, I don't know that there's an actual dollar amount that it's not. We haven't broken it down into that much detail. Certainly, it's more lopsided at the high prices than it is at the lower prices, whether that's $50, whether that's $60, I couldn't tell you. It's certainly something we can look into. We've run a lot of models, and there may be an area that we can say that looks reasonable when compared to, you know, other places that might invest, but that's not something I have off the top of my head.
I mean, that to me is the critical question. If you're asking, if people are asking us to fix the tax system and saying that it's broke, we need to know where it's broke. We need to know at what price point it becomes broke. So I think, at least for me, that's critical information to have.
Through the chair, Senator Wilkowski, I agree. And the fact that we haven't heard a minute of testimony from the people that are paying the taxes in this committee is the important part of the discussion, I think. We're, 90 days last year, 30 days this year, we're 120 days into it, and we haven't had 1 minute of testimony here. So they're the ones that are paying the taxes. They're the ones that are deciding whether to invest here or not. It's the private sector that's making that decision based on the tax system that's in place.
If I might add, there are a number of inferences from that last statement, the least of which is that you have nothing to say on where the system's broke. Is that accurate?
I do not believe I said that, sir.
Anyways. Well, I mean, this isn't the oil company's bill. This is your bill. I mean, the HB 110 I'm referring to. You proposed that we roll back oil taxes the way you proposed it. And so I assume when you did that, you had some inclination that it was broken at some point. And now you're saying you don't know if it's broke or where it's broke. Am I hearing you correctly?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Wilkowski, I'm saying I don't know of an exact dollar that we can say, okay, at 58, things are just fine. At 59, it's a little high. I mean, we looked at it generally much like you did when you passed the bill specifically. I could be wrong, but maybe ACES was passed saying we're shooting for $71 or $67. And so we've looked at it kind of in stages of what we believed was high or too high, not a particular dollar that it works at, because if there's one thing we know about a dollar is that it's never going to be that dollar ever.
And just one follow-up on, since you referred to HB 110, the two critical parts of that bill were putting a cap in place and then putting the brackets in place. The cap is an absolute. The brackets make it easier and more understandable to calculate. It's more based on the federal system. So we believe those are the two critical portions of HB 110. Now, we're still going to be taxing higher than anybody else in North America. So while it's still an incredibly high tax, it's not as high as ACES, and we think that with the cap in place at these higher prices and the brackets in place, that it would be a substantial change and would help move the needle, certainly.
Senator Steadman had a question.
Just a couple, Mr. Chairman, just for clarity on the record, we haven't had the bill for, 100 and some odd days or whatever was referenced earlier with no public testimony. We're just getting going. But with that being said, the chart here with showing the production tax value, again, this is where it gets, I think, confusing for the public. If we have these charts consistently dealing with, the price of oil, not the production tax value of it, like your previous slide, we'd be able to bench back and forth. Because initially, you just want to look at, oil is roughly 110 forecasted in FY13. You'd look at the 110 bar, and you'd think that's where we're at. But at 110, roughly, there's only $22 billion in gross stock, yet those bars add up to $24 billion. So obviously, that doesn't work. So you got to back out roughly your production tax value about $70. And it'd be nice to look at these charts somewhere in the realm of where we're at. It's nice to go out and look at that $235 plus cost, plus another $70, that's $300 a barrel of oil. It's twice as high as it's ever been in the history. So I think it'd be more beneficial in our process, Mr. Chairman, that we concentrate more in the realm of where we have been, which is south of 150. I think 140 something, mid-40s was the maximum price. Within that range, we should certainly get a pretty good scoped in feel of where our tax structure needs to be modified. And if we can fix it in that range, we can go north of there and make sure it works. Because I think it's just extremely difficult to flip back and forth unless you happen to have your production tax value memorized for FY13 and you assume that this is FY13 and you also assume then that you've got 35% federal tax rate was most likely implied here. Is that correct? I'd like to know the accountants that work for BP, Conoco, or Exxon, where they pay 35%. I'll show you the next accountant that's going to get terminated.
Through the chair, Senator Steadman, I agree that, and again, we're getting into the complexities of our tax system that we have, and trying to get through 14 slides or 18 slides in one presentation is difficult enough, but trying to show a slide that's representative that the public would understand. And I think this is a very illustrative slide that the public can understand, that as price goes from $35 to $235, the only segment they're realizing the upside is the state. And the producers are more or less flat in comparison. So I think it's more illustrative on how the split is done between the three entities.
If a couple points. One of them, I think we should agree that, hopefully we can agree, that the industry doesn't pay a 35% rate. Conoco publishes their information. We should get a ballpark figure of where they're at, and we can extrapolate out where their competitors in that range. Because if we assign that portion of the profit oil always at 35%, our numbers are going to be too far off on the portion that goes to the Uncle Sam. The other point is production tax value is more complex than the marginal and effective tax rate. And if the public gets confused over the marginal tax versus effective tax, I would be surprised if you went up to the average guy on the street and asked him what the production tax value was, he'd have any idea even what you're talking about. How can they follow us at home with these kind of terms? We need to boil this down, Mr. Chairman, and put it in ways where the Alaskans, who own the oil, by the way, our tax is a methodology where we recoup the market value to the resource owner, which is us. This is not taxing something that we don't own. So they understand what we're doing here. So, you know, and again, it's early in the process and we can work on these things, but I think we can show a lot of clarity, and I think it'd be easier for the department to make their arguments and the industry to make their arguments and for us to have our deliberative process if we had a more cohesive and transparent lay of the information on the table.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Stedman, I agree with you, and we're very willing and eager to do that. What we were trying to do in an 18-slide snapshot that we will be lucky to get through in two hearings is to just hit on a bunch of different topics. As you can see, we don't really have the opportunity to dig into great detail on anything, or we'd be here for weeks. And I know that, you know, we've been fairly limited on the time that you wanted to give us because you've got other presentations, and that's fine. But that's, it's been more of a snapshot than it, you know, in other committees we've gone into great detail, and we're excited to do that in your committee as well.
Follow.
As far as I'm concerned, Mr. Chairman, I know there's always the target of the time frame that we want to get this done by particular dates and so on and so forth, but we're dealing with billions of dollars in the future of the state, and I personally want the details. So
I agree with Senator Stedman on that. And again, getting back to the whole purpose of the hearing that we started last Friday was to request the Department of Revenue to define the problem, because what I believe a concern may be is that if we start advancing solutions, you lose sight of the problem. So when the question was asked, where do you believe it's broken, that is an attempt to define the problem so that we get into ready, aim, shoot as compared to ready, shoot, aim. And so I'm trying to have, if we can, as best as possible, the Department of Revenue define the problem for us. So,
and I appreciate that, Mr. Chairman. And I didn't mean for my response to make it sound like I don't think we're getting enough time. I just meant the response was we were trying to, in a fairly small number of slides and a fairly small number of time, do that. Like I said, we're certainly excited to dig into as much detail as you want. We have it already. It's just not part of this presentation.
Seeing no further questions.
Okay, this we put together, Mr. Chairman, with the use of Mr. Van Muir's PetroCash model. In comparing to our international peers, government take over the project life cycle of a 50 million barrel field. And as you can see, down near the bottom is Canada, Beaufort Sea, and Northwest Territories take at different prices. Working up to U.S. Gulf of Mexico, U.K., and then up near the top, as you can see, is Alaska and Norway. And so this is a more of a country snapshot, similar to what we put in our fiscal regime, as opposed to a state-by-state snapshot, which is something that we had spoken of previously.
Senator French has a question.
Thank you. Regarding Norway, Commissioner, do you think there's a healthy level of industry investment in Norway?
Through the chair, Senator French, I'm not an expert on Norway, but there seems to be.
Thank you.
Senator Wilkowski.
Following up on that, Norway has a 78% tax all across dollar one of profit. Do you, so is it your position that, because Norway appears to be doing well, they appear to be having a good investment there, do you think it's just the government take that we need to look at, or do you think there are other factors that we should be looking at? Maybe Norway does state direct financial investment. Do you think there are other things other than taxes, other levers that we should be pulling to get more investment, to get more production in Alaska?
Through the chair, Senator Wilikowski, yes, I do. Obviously, Norway is a country, Alaska is a state. Norway has a state-owned oil company. Norway controls their permits. There's a lot of differences between Norway and Alaska. Permitting is an example. Taxes is a huge issue, but permitting is as well. And that's something the Department of Natural Resources has been working on. Unfortunately, the federal government aspect of it is something that we don't have control over. And taking a look at what happened with CD5 is a good example of something that you probably didn't see in Norway, just because it's a country and it's you deal with different issues with a country than you do with a state in a federal bureaucracy.
Senator Stedman has a
while we're on the mad Norwegians, we spent quite a bit of time last go around looking at Norway as a comparative, and one of the things that have been pointed out to me when we deal with Norway is that as mentioned earlier, we have a fairly robust marginal tax rate, where their marginal tax rate's flat because of their structure. So if we could, Mr. Chairman, maybe ask the department to come back with a effective and marginal tax rate comparison between Norway and Alaska. Because I think that the marginal issue is substantially different between the two, but the effective tax rate is fairly similar.
Through the chair, Senator Stedman, we'd be happy to do that. But as well, we're going to have to discuss kind of the apples and oranges difference of those. I don't think you can take the effective tax rate of Alaska and Norway without discussing the structure that Norway has and some of the positives that you have when you invest in Norway that you don't get when you invest in the state of Alaska in the United States.
Mr. Chairman, I was just trying to help his argument because Norway's got a flat marginal rate, and I think that's probably one of the biggest issues on the table. So just
through the chair, Senator Stedman, yeah, absolutely. It's just there's so much apples and oranges going on that I guess it's hard for me to bite my tongue sometimes.
So the answer is yes. Senator Stedman and the committee will receive it.
That is the answer, Mr. Okay. Chairman. And this is used with Mr. Van Meers' PetroCash model again, focusing on the largest jurisdictions of oil producers in North America, North Dakota, California, Texas, Alberta, Oklahoma, as well as OCS in federal waters, Alaska, and ACES in Alaska. And once again, you can see it over different oil price barrels, and government take as percent of divisible income.
Senator Stedman has a question.
If we could request the commissioner too to maybe rerun these slides with the comparative exporting basins that were presented to the finance committee here that we're all at here a couple hours ago by Mr. Van Meers, so we'd have those. I think he gave us a list of what he thought was comparative oil basins, four of them.
Mm-hmm.
Through the chair, Senator Stedman, we'd be happy to do that. I know that I only caught a little bit of it because we were in committee, but he did seem to show a shift between what Alaska's peers were in 1997 and what they are in 2012, which was a shift to North America and away from some of the countries that had previously been our peers, but we'd be happy to do that.
If, you know, slide 18 talks about divisible income, that seems to be PTV, so to speak, but, for example, North Dakota has a royalty and a production tax system that's gross. So how do you compare, how do you say it's divisible income if they are a gross system and we are partially a net system?
Through the chair, Senator Passman, I don't know if we have the appropriate folks online, but again, this is modeled off of Mr. Van Meer's PetroCash model, so we can get you some of the details on how that model is set up and how the apples versus oranges comparisons are handled within the model themselves.
In other words, it would seem to me that if we're going to compare ourselves to North Dakota or Texas, that it would be a percent of gross, because their systems analyze gross.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, as there would need to be estimates on what expenditures were similar to what we had when we were in a gross. But if we didn't deal with those kinds of estimates, we wouldn't be able to compare ourselves to anybody in North America, seeing as we're the only net jurisdiction.
Senator Stedman has a question.
They probably misspoke and didn't mean to use divisible income, but total government take. It takes the issue away off the table. But you could speak for yourself.
Okay. Through the chair, Senator Stedman, this slide, like I said, which was produced with the PetroCash model, says it's the percentages or the government take as a percentage of divisible income. And then a total government take over the life of the project.
Okay. Senator Likowski has a question.
Hey, thank you, Mr. Chair. Looks like we're just about near the end here, so I just wanted to ask a general question. And we, as you know, we had a few days of testimony last week from Mr. Richard, Robin Brenna and Craig Richards, and they had some suggestions other than tax changes. They thought there were some vertical integration issues, some transparency, a lack of transparency issues, some facilities access issues, tariff pipeline bottleneck issues. And I'm just curious if you give any merit to any of the suggestions that they made.
Through the chair, Senator Wilkowski, is there anything more specific you'd want us to speak to?
I could be happy to get you the list of suggestions that they made, and if you could take a look at those and see if you agree or disagree, I'd just be interested in the administration's take on what their suggestions
are. Through the chair, Senator Wilkowski, absolutely.
Well, Commissioner, I think we're through with that presentation, and you know, I would, if we can see where we can power through in the five-year look-back presentation, possibly we can make up some territory.
I don't think so, but we can try.
We're not gooey ducks. No gooey ducks today. Oh, we're going to do five, right?
Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, again, Brian Butcher, Commissioner of the Department of Revenue. With us, I have Donna Keppers, who is one of our three audit masters and who was oversaw the five-year look-back project that we've been working on and will continue to work on. This came about primarily as a result of last year's discussions when we talked about tax credits, capital expenditures, where is the money going, where is it being spent, what light can the department shine on much of that information. At the time, we didn't know whether that was something that we needed to pass a bill for or whether that was something that we could do under our current regulations. We talked to the Department of Law, who determined that this is something we could do out of our department under our current regulations, that there's information, more of a breakdown in spending by the industry that we had not been asking for at the department, that we could under regs ask for. And so that's what began this project. It began the month after the legislative session ended, and it's broken out into two pieces. The first is we ask companies to do a five-year look back to break out their capital expenditures into different categories, and in that it was broken out into primarily five categories. Some of the issues we had to deal with when having workshops with the companies were They all have different ways of putting their numbers together over this five-year period, and so we separated out into two pieces. Piece number one would be a five-year look back, would be more general categories of where their capital expenditures were. The second piece of it would be a look forward, where the department would say, okay, we want a lot more detailed categories of broken down with not just your capital expenditures, but your operating expenditures. We want this to be part of your tax return when you file your production taxes. And so as we go through here, you'll see we have a more general five-year look back in terms of information, and we expect to have a far more detailed look ahead where we can actually work with companies going forward to say, here are the areas we would like you to break down your spending, and we should be able to come back on a yearly basis to the committee and give you more of a detailed idea of where the spending's been compared to what we had in the past and what we have today. This discusses
possibly you could jump forward to page 5. I think that, you know, okay, just good. To power through some of this, because I think some of it is self-explanatory, and we just don't need to, you know, or I would, wherever you think, so we can get into the nuts and bolts.
I would appreciate that, Mr. Chairman. Happy to do that. Page 5 talks a little bit about why we did that, which I just kind of hit on, which was to catch up on years of data collection and to get informative cost information to you, the decision makers. As part of this, we spent a lot of time in-house discussing what categories we thought it should be separated into. We conducted 4 workshops with the industry, and I believe, Mr. Chairman, you sat in on at least one of them.
Yes, I did.
We averaged about 15 companies per workshop. Industry was responsive, both in their participation in the workshops and in written comments, and worked with us very well in trying to compile this information, helped establish the expenditure categories, and in developing both the look back as well as the forward-looking reporting. The five-year look back looks at 2006 to 2010. It doesn't look at 2011 because the calendar year 2011 will have the true-ups by the companies March 31st of 2012, so that's information that we don't have final numbers on yet. So we do it through 2010. The look forward will be beginning for calendar year 2012 and will be reported March of 2013. So next year at this time, 2011, will be added to our look back. As I mentioned before, this information in the looking forward will be submitted with the annual production tax returns and based on confidential information. The category breakdown for the look back was in 5 basic categories. First is geological and geophysical work, G&G. And presentation. And this is includes work and or costs associated with the performance or acquisition of seismic and or geological and geophysical data. Exploration drilling was a different category. That includes drilling an exploration well, an appraisal well that is post-discovery and prior to development, and including sidetracks on the discovery well, appraisal costs including coring and testing discovery wells. The development drilling, which includes costs associated with well drilling, completions, planned multilaterals of development wells, including costs upstream, and also includes all costs related to well workovers and completions. Facilities, which was a large piece of it. It includes well tie-in costs, expansions of existing facilities such as increasing oil, gas or water handling, increases to capacity, debottlenecking or processing facilities, improvements to reliability or reduced operational costs, production control system upgrades, IT, communications equipment, control systems, campsites, medical facilities, laboratories, warehouses, any facilities that would fall generally into that category. And the fifth is a catch-all other capital, which includes significant capital equipment, health, safety, environment, other non-drilling related costs that weren't captured in the previous 4 categories. Approximately 90% of...
Senator Stedman had a question.
Well, just I didn't mean to have interrupt on the slide, but just as you go forward through the next few slides, could you try to point out what was available for the 20% capital expenditures and
credits, 20% capital credits, along with immediate write-off as you walk through these slides so we can kind of keep track of that stuff?
Yeah. Through the chair, Senator Steadman, we don't have that kind of detail yet, but we'll see what we can do in terms of getting more of a breakdown. The categorized capital expenditure data represents approximately 90% of the costs related to credit applications that the department has seen. And at this point, I will pass it over to Donna, who can dig into some of the details of what we've actually discovered.
Thank you. For the record, my name is Donna Keppers, Audit Master for the Department of Revenue. As the Commissioner said, the categorized capital expenditure data represents 90% of the costs related to qualified capital expenditures. And that's an important fact, because this means that a company can have costs greater than those reported for credit purposes, because they may have costs that they have chosen not to apply for a credit on. The first slide, on slide 9, what you'll see is 2006, it's footnoted, includes 9 months of due to PPT that was effective for 1 of 2006, so that's a short year. And then you can see the total inception to date for the five-year period is, totals out to be $9.3 billion. The two largest categories, as you can see, are facilities in the red and development in the green. The overall trend is increased spending. The increases are likely maintaining production, as there are no major increases or decreases in any one category. In regard to development, drilling, and facilities, there were increases in development, drilling, and facilities in 2007 and 2008, and you see a decline in 9. And 2009 would have been the first year that ACES would have possibly had some effect on budgets and activities. The increase in spending in both development wells and facilities in 2010 was greater than in years prior to 2009. It provided no significant indication of ACES influences, but may be a reflection of the credit program and more targeted spending for credits qualifying for spend. In a broader perspective for total companies, development drilling, which is the green, $4.2 billion, could be viewed as relatively flat, or it generally demonstrated no dramatic increase during the four-year period. The red section, the other $4.2 billion, the red, for facilities, that spend mirrored that of development and could be interpreted as simply supporting existing production from existing fields. And also, the slight fluctuation in total expenditures for these categories could also be attributed to annual cost increases for labor or services, materials, and not necessarily reflect an increase in overall development activity.
For example, 2009 is to some extent possibly consistent with the world and U.S. economic downturn.
All of those have an impact on costs, yes, sir. On slide 10, we put together drilling and G&G costs, and so that you could actually see maybe a little more clearly the green bars for development, where you're looking at $4.2 billion, and you kind of see where you had increases from 2007 to 8. And then it goes down from 2008 to 2009, and then it kind of goes back up between 2009 and 2010. The multifold increases are not reflected in development drilling. After the increase in 2007, spending stays fairly level for the remainder of the reporting period. And this agrees with statements made by some companies that they have had level spend to develop existing fields and are not pursuing new finds or development of new fields. On slide 11, we see a cut for the other large category for all companies, which is facilities. And what we saw is that some of the costs were for new development and some was for replacement of aging facility operations. And as the commissioner stated earlier, facilities is a very broad category. And we couldn't drill down for the look back just due to the compressed time frame and just the volume of information that was needed for the companies to actually compile that looking back 5 years.
Senator Wilkowski has a question.
Thank you. Could you give me an example of what would be some examples of CapEx spending for facilities and some examples of OpEx spending for facilities?
John Larson, are you on the line? Lenny Dees, are you on the line?
Yeah, this is John Larson. I'm an audit master with the Department of Revenue. And the question was about CapEx and OpEx types costs.
I'm just trying to get give me maybe a few examples of what would be a CapEx cost for facilities and an OpEx expenditure for facilities.
Sure. The capital expenditures are going to have a longer type life. It'll be related to your buildings. Your vessels for handling the production. The OPEX is, I'm going to say, by and large, going to be labor and materials.
The record should reflect that Senator Egan has been here for quite a while. Sorry, I didn't recognize you earlier. So, anyway, that's right. Commissioner, if we could continue, I think we should try to wrap this up, and then I think we got enough time for Senator Egan, and we can get to the...
We can finish this pretty quickly.
Yes, we can finish this fairly quickly. The next two slides are total green bars. We, because of the confidentiality restrictions, we had a difficult time trying to split up costs between independents and majors that were also broken down by cost category. And so we had to actually lump the costs together because for 2008, 2009, and 2010, we couldn't meet the aggregation factor of three or more companies. And so that is why all of those costs are aggregated by year for purposes of the look back. For the period reviewed, it was $2.6 billion in total capital expenditures for the independent companies. What we did see that was fairly significant is we saw capital expenditures increase in 2008 through 2010. They increased by approximately 67% for the independents. And those expenditures have jumped, which may be due to the increased activity in the smaller producing fields.
Senator Stedman.
Just for clarity for those at home watching, could you give us a rough idea what reimbursement the state would be making on this $805 million in credits? Their net cost is an $805, so.
That's a question that we'll probably have to work with Lenny on to get down to some detail.
Through the chair, Senator Stedman, we'll get you details on that.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And I think that would be a very interesting to not have it just for the independents, but
for the majors as well.
If a major were to spend money, what is it? How does the state participate in that?
We can do that. Slide 13 is a similar slide with total CapEx for the major companies that equates to $6.7 billion. The increase for them for the same time period of 2008 to 2010 was approximately 5%. The data indicated no major increases overall in spending totals, especially in those most recent 3 years.
Senator Stedman has a question.
When the request goes out for expectations in 13, 14, 15, and 16,
FY for capital expenditures. Could you, on that, could you break it down by these two charts also, the independents and the majors?
Yes, sir, we can do that.
Yes, through the chair, Senator Stedman, yes,
sir. And then if you could have them just added to these same charts so there's just more bars on them so we don't have to flip back and forth and worry about axes changing and things like that.
Yes, sir, we can do that.
And then jumping to the conclusions, we have actual breakdowns of this for the first time, albeit it's more limited categories in a look back than it is in a look forward, because we're dealing with a lot of different departments in a company, a different way of doing things, different IT, and we tried to work it in a way that we could get information looking back while still having it be timely and not taking years. Moving forward, we're going to be breaking down, as an example, the facilities piece, we're going to be breaking down into many subsets in working with the industry, and we'll be having further workshops. Certainly anyone is invited to. They're open to the public, and it gives you a better sense of some of the hurdles that you deal with when you're dealing with everything from a small company to a huge multinational company in terms of trying to have them all submit something in a more uniform way. Capital expenditures from 2007 to 2010 increased from just under $2 billion to about $2.4 billion. Explorers seem to spend most of their money on drilling wells and G&G. Companies in the development stage spend money on development, drilling, and facilities. Companies in transition spend monies in multiple areas, depending on where they were in the stage of the project that they were working on. And the companies in mature production phase spend money on maintenance and upgrade of facilities and development wells. And also, as I know you're all aware, we have more players active in the field. Moving forward, we're working on the proposed annual cost supplemental information report. As I mentioned earlier, we'll have one more year of look back, and then starting with calendar year 2012, we'll be able to use more detailed categories following additional workshops with the industry. We've discussed it with them. We've given them a general breakdown. We've got about four pages of different categories, definitions of the categories. We haven't gotten to the point yet where we've ironed out exactly what we'll be asking companies to provide in what detail, but they're working with us. They know that that's where we're moving, and we expect it to be hopefully a fairly seamless move to that point, so we can give, with every additional year, more and more detail on where the spending is.
Commissioner, seeing no further questions, I do thank you for, and Donna, thank you for powering through this. We will now transition into Gooey Duck and transfer the gavel.
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you.
Thank you, Commissioner, and thank you to your department for putting that information together for us.
The bill we have in front of us would be House Bill 60. This would be the initial presentation of the bill by the bill sponsor. And it has a referral from here to finance when we get through with it. So this time I'd ask for a motion on the bill. Mr. Co-Chair.
Chair, I move that we move Senate Bill 60.
House Bill 60. Or,
excuse me, House Bill 60.
Backslash A.
To this committee for purposes of discussion.
I'll object for discussion purposes. With that, Representative Seaton, you want to take the seat? Present your bill. Please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I appreciate the time and the effort the committee is taking, and appreciate the attention of the committee. House Bill 60 works on trying to promote economic development around the coast of Alaska. It is very difficult to get a new economic base in many coastal towns, especially those that will not conflict in time with salmon and herring fishing.
House Bill 60 allows for subtitle farming of gooey duck clams, and a little description on clams. Are they large in size, averaging about 2.5 pounds, about 7 inches long? They're a filter feeder. In other words, they're not going out grabbing up other things to eat. They're sitting on the bottom in the mud, generally 2 to 3 feet down in one place their entire life. They're not mobile. They're not like razor clams that can dig fast. They stay in one place. They just pull down their siphon and they don't move at all. So they're not interfering with other types of fisheries. They're in mud flats. So the competition for their the habitat they're in are worms and tunicates, which are a small sessile animal that aren't commercially or really even used in subsistence purposes. And there has never been anything shown that the presence of gooey duck clams inhibits either the number of worms or the number of tunicates in the areas. So the whole plan that we've proposed here is simply necessary because the Department of Fishery or Department of Fish and Game has a informal policy that they don't allow gooey ducks, which are native in Alaska, south of here, to go to the single hatchery, certified hatchery in the state in Seward for raising and being distributed to farms anywhere other than where they're already occurring, that's in southeast. And you may have heard over the years about the conflict that's arisen in gooey ducks, and that's been because you have wild stock which is harvested by divers, and then people wanting to put farms in good habitat where there's already a wild stock and an existing resource. What we're trying to do here is allow gooey ducks to be farmed in areas where there's not a native gooey duck population. And the probability is that since the water has to be warmer before they will spawn, that they'll be just like oysters up in Kachemak Bay, where they never reach a temperature to spawn. And so we're not talking about a proliferation of the species. However, if the species would proliferate, you have to realize that, that would be a great bonus for Alaska, because these clams are, right now, they're at $21 a pound from the fishermen. So it's a very good resource. It's also very good for the communities around the coast, because gooey ducks, unlike oysters or mussels that have to be tended two or three times every summer, gooey ducks are put in the ground, put in the sediment, a small piece of plastic pipe with a net on the top of it to keep out any predators, while they're very small, quarter inch, half inch. And 2 years later, those are taken off. In about 7 years, you are in harvest mode, but you don't have to do anything to those clams in the meantime. I do have a short video if we can show that, and then we'll see how they're harvested and all, if that would be acceptable to the committee.
Sure. Cartoon.
Yeah. A little soda and
beer. Popcorn and beer.
Down 3 feet, and you need to really get it out.
So I thought that that was a much clearer rendition of many of the things that you've seen. You saw them harvesting underwater. That's the way they do it, and from boats, and they're diving. House Bill 60 simply says that you can't use the absence of a gooey ducks in an area to deny a plan permit. And this would be for all areas around the Gulf of Alaska. It'd be Kodiak, Yakutat, Chignik, on out west. It does not include Kachemak Bay. Kachemak Bay is a critical habitat and does not allow bottom farming in Kachemak Bay. So just for clarity, but like down at Seldovia or down at below Seldovia at Port Graham, Nanwalek, those would be areas there. Again, it's the bill limits it to subtitle, and the reason it was limited to subtitle and not intertitle is because then we make sure that we don't get any interference with subsistence or sport fisheries, boat landings, or any of those kind of things. And so the only other thing that I'd probably say is that this is a very clean, renewable fishery. Depends on clean water, so you have people making sure that you don't get pollution. You've probably heard about the state has larval drift zones, they're called, and those were for genetic purposes to make sure that if you were enhancing a clam species in an area, you had to take the stock from that same area, raise up the seed, and then replant from that same stock so that you didn't get genetic crosses and those things. Realize this bill is specifically for taking clam seed to an area where there are no natural stocks, so we don't have to worry at all about any genetic interference with native stocks. And so, you know, I would hope that we can help get a new economic base for people around rural Alaska, and I'd appreciate that. And anyway, I'd be happy to try and answer any questions.
What's the main predator, Paul, on the gooey ducks as they're being raised?
As they're being raised, it's when they're juveniles, and it's starfish. And that's why they take a little 3-inch or 4-inch PVC pipe with a little mesh on the top. They put about 3 of them down and put a little cone over and then take it off a year or so later.
Senator Stevens.
I just thought that being a gooey duck sounds like a lot like being on this committee. you threw feet under the mud, and you don't know who's telling you the truth and who to believe. But on a serious note, just a question, Paul. I've never heard this before. But are gooey ducks susceptible to red tide as other clams are? Do you happen to know that? Or
gooey ducks are filter feeders, and so if you have a plankton bloom, that's true. This bill does not exempt any farm from all of the health and safety criteria that all mariculture farms must do, and so the clams have to be tested before they're sold.
Mr. Chairman,
and Senator Stevens,
just want to make sure, and the Looted Pride Shellfish Hatchery is ready to supply the needs of this new industry?
Absolutely. One of the problems with the only shellfish hatchery we have in the state is that its business plan was based on sale of seed so that it could be self-sustaining, and gooey duck seed are much more valuable than oyster seed. And without being able to distribute to more farms than just in Southeastern, that business plan has not been able to be realized, and this should make the the shellfish hatchery self-sustaining.
Senator Wilikowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I know you've been pushing this bill for a long time, and my recollection is that at some point there were some concerns by Fish and Game about this, and are there concerns today? Have they been resolved?
Through the chair, Senator Wilikowski, yes, they have. The department, at least at the last hearing, testified they are neutral on the bill. You know, one of the issues that I identified earlier were these larval drift zone ideas, but that is for genetic continuity of it and contamination, and there is no question of that here. And so they have Fish and Game has identified no disease problems with any, and there have been never any in any farms or in the wild stock. So they have come out neutral on the bill.
Thank you.
Senator French.
Any opposition to the bill?
There has been no opposition to the bill since Fish and Game has come out being neutral to the bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you.
Any other questions on the sponsor? Seeing no more questions, thank you, Paul. Next, we'll go to public hearings. There are no off-nets authorized, so we'll go to the LIOs. Is there anybody in the LIO that wishes to testify? Okay. Next, we'll come back to Juneau. There's two people in Juneau who would like to testify. First person is Paul Fuse.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, and again, thanks for hearing this.
Mr. Fuse, before you talk, just for the committee's information, we also have Jeff Hetrick from the Shellfish Hatchery available for answering questions if you have any questions for him. So go ahead, please identify
Paul
yourself.
Paul Fuse representing Alaska Sea Farms, and it's the operation that's growing greed, the biggest operation growing greed ducks in Southeast. And we support this bill. You know, I live up in South Central, and, you know, I would intend to be involved in this. We've already talked to Fish and Game. If you pass this, it's not going to be a wasted effort. We would go immediately to a research permit, go in and get some in the ground and see how they grow mortalities and things like that. We don't have any experience with it yet, but they're growing in Resurrection Bay water right now from the hatchery. That's with the water that's taken in to grow them in. So I don't see any reason why that shouldn't work. The market has just gone off the deep end for goey ducks. You know, $21 to the fisherman, that's the highest priced fish in the state of Alaska. So it takes about 7 to 8 years to grow them. But once you get them in the ground, that's all you need to do is to let them grow. So it's really good for rural Alaska. What makes South Central so good is that it's the logistics. The transportation is there, the hatchery's there, the PSP testing is there, all of that. I mean, that's what we fight in Southeast all the time. So I think it could be even more successful in South Central.
Any questions of Mr. Foos?
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Stevens.
I'm sorry, Paul. I'm really, I don't quite understand this process. Maybe help us through it. So you decide you want to have a gooey duck farm. You buy the spat. You grow the gooey ducks. How does ownership happen? I mean,
you get
maybe just explain that so that other people can't harvest your gooey duck, I assume.
You get a lease from the state of Alaska. And from that, you do have exclusive use of the clams on your site. We don't worry too much about people coming and taking them because they're not a big item on most people's menu. But, you know, you have to prove that the water is clean. You have to take over a year's worth of water samples. You don't want to be anywhere near where there's a discharge of a sewer or anything like that. You have to stake it off. You have to get a permit to transfer the seed from the hatchery. But that's it. And then, you know, the lease lasts for 10 years. The lease is renewable. And so we've had some of these farms now for 10 years, and we are selling our first adult gooey ducks out of that.
Thank you.
So that's how it works. It's a state tide land lease.
How much does an initial gooey duck, the first year of the sale, what are the average weight of them?
Well, I mean, they in 7 to 8 years, they've grown up to 2 pounds.
Oh, okay.
I mean, they're pretty much at their full. They'll add a little bit of additional weight, and then they just keep growing and living. I think the longest one is like 148 years old that they found. It's a very, very long-lived animal. But we sell them at about 2 pounds. That's about the ideal weight, but they grow quite quickly.
Okay. Any other questions? Thank you, Paul. Next person to testify is Roger Painter.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Roger Painter, and I'm president of the Alaskan Shellfish Growers Association. And we support House Bill 60. We've been working for it for several years with Representative Seaton. As you heard from that $21 a pound figure cost to the value to the fishermen, market is very strong. It seems to be getting stronger all the time. There's a pretty major aquaculture operations, gooey duck aquaculture operations in Puget Sound, and they're doing very, very well. And we've had some interest in investments up here. We have in at least two different farms that have expressed interest in trying this in South Central. And I think it can be successful, but you don't know until you put the animals in the ground. And we've been unsuccessful to this point in convincing Fish and Game to do an experimental type approach without this kind of legislation in place. So I'd urge the committee to pass the bill out, and let's get moving.
Thank you. Any questions, Roger? By the way, Roger's a past constituent of mine. He never was, really. He moved out of the peninsula before that. But thank you very much, Roger.
And then I'll check for it.
With that, there's nobody else signed up to testify. Senator Wilikowski?
Is there someone from Fish and Game, I think, online? Or from the...
No, just from the shellfish hatchery.
Is that the state? Is that run by the state, I assume?
No, is that state hatchery?
Okay.
Yeah.
Could I...
That's over Seward. Jeff Hetrick is his name.
Could I have a
couple questions? Go ahead and ask
him a question. Okay, he's online. Do you see any problems with this to the ecosystem or a disease or anything like that?
No, as Mr. Fuse said, we're currently using Resurrection Bay water. We treat that water prior to coming into the hatchery with filters, and we chlorinate it prior to it, the effluent going back into Resurrection Bay. So there should be no disease concerns. Ecosystem-wide, really can't answer that question, but there are other clam populations, and subtitally, we don't expect to have any competition between gooey duck clams and anything else.
And then if I could just follow up on acreage, how much acreage do you anticipate leasing? How many gooey ducks do you allow per acre?
Well, as Mr. Hughes again said earlier, the first time through this, a fisheries resource permit would just be a small plot to kind of proof of concept and identify the sites that would be applicable. I think for DNR and Fish and Game, the minimum size farm is 2 acres for a commercially viable farm. I'm not exactly sure how many gooey ducks the farmers plant per acre, but you're talking about hundreds of thousands per acre, I'm sure.
Okay. And then just one last question. So do you have like spacing between the acreage, or do you just lease out the whole sound, or I mean, how does that work?
Well, there's a fee based for the amount of acreage you lease, so it's sort of is a deterrent to take more space than you actually need. But typically farms are contiguous, so you'd have acreage side by side, remembering that some of these sites are very specific in the habitat that they require. So, of course, you wouldn't be taking steep rocky slopes. You'd be more looking for gentle sand, sandy bottoms, or light gravel bottoms. And those types of areas are somewhat minimized. We are working with the Sea Life Center and some local professional dive shops to go and identify some of these locations for the first proof of concept for in Resurrection Bay anyway, and perhaps there'll be other people stepping forward with sites There's been lots of talk about that, but nothing's happened yet.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair.
Questions? Sure.
Senator Stevens has a question.
Thank you. You know, on first blush, it seems like, I mean, this is a great idea for some of the smaller communities around the state, maybe some of the villages. But, of course, they are off the road systems. I guess my question is, and I'm not sure who it's to, but what is the form that these credits are sold? Are they processed, or are they going to be sent out live? And if they are sent out live, how do we handle that out of some smaller communities? Paul Fuse.
Yes, Representing Senator Stevens, Paul Fuse, Alaska Sea Farms. We take them from remote locations right now. They're delivered by the dock, but they're sold live, and we have to ship them live. So as soon as they hit the dock, they go into chill mode, and then they're sent up and immediate flown over. So, we did some experimentation with trying to process some of them, but the market really didn't want that. They wanted a live gooey duck, so almost all of them go over live. Sometimes you can sell them processed, but the price is far, far lower than a live gooey duck.
And through the chair, they will survive for some period of time?
They will, and the other thing that we found is that it really helps, like some of them are delivered, you know, into Craig or some of the other areas. Well, that's cargo for the smaller airlines. So this really helps, you know, local airlines, ships, fuel, divers, I mean, all the ancillary services that go around it. It really helps build an economy around the industry. So I think you'd see the same thing. It just, if you got to fly it out to Port Graham, for instance, or something like that, it's going to take a little bite out of your profit. But these things are being sold for so much now, I still think they'd be able to make it.
I was going to say, Paul, I was going to ask you that question. Thanks for bringing it up. If some of the native corporations wanted to go into Dewey Duck farming, like Port Graham, probably be a perfect place because you don't get a big surge in there or anything, and it's a pretty shallow bay. Can they be transported like to Homer with a boat and then put on the airplane in Homer?
Yes, they could.
Okay.
Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Senator Wilkowski. Thank you.
Just on the harvesting, hundreds of thousands, do you harvest, is it all hand-picked by scuba divers, or do you have machines or trawling or anything?
What they do, they're dug in so hard that they take a water jet, and the diver goes down and grabs it, and you put that water jet down, and it kind of loosens the dirt a little bit to where you can wrestle it out. But it's tough. I mean, you're going to work for it. So a diver can harvest about 1,000 animals a day, something like that, but you're going to be tired. But you're not diving that deep. You're in, 15 to 40 feet of water. So
use hookah gear?
The hookah, sometimes hard hat, sometimes scuba. Yeah.
Any further questions? Thanks. Oh, excuse me.
Nothing other than to say.
Senator Wilkowski.
Nothing other than to say you learn something new every day, Mr. Chairman.
With that, there's no other testimony. We'll close the public testimony. And I'd remove my objection. I'd this time ask for a motion out of committee with individual recommendations and fiscal notes.
So moved.
Any objection? Hearing seen none, the bill will move. Thank you very much. I was going to ask a question, but I didn't want to ask it on the record. Let's go off the record.